Stuart. All right, good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting on Monday the 16th of February 2026. My name is Paula Reid, Mayor of Kingborough. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to tonight's meeting. Welcome to those who are in the public gallery and also to anyone who is watching along at home. Time being 5:30pm, I now officially declare the meeting open. Council now operates under the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations 2025, and under these I am required to advise you that A, an audio or audiovisual recording is being made of the meeting. B, all persons attending the meeting are to be respectful of and considerate towards other persons attending the meeting. And C, language and conduct at the meeting that could be perceived as offensive, defamatory or threatening to a person attending the meeting or listening to the recording is not acceptable. The audio recording of council meetings is made publicly available on our website and meetings are live streamed on YouTube. I'll now ask staff to confirm that the audio recording has started. Thank you. Could I also ask that everyone has their mobile phones on silent if they aren't already? Thank you. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land that we meet on, pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Our attendees this evening are myself, Councillor Reid, the Deputy Mayor, Councillor Gladright, Councillor Antoli, Councillor Bain, Councillor Cordover, Councillor Dean, Councillor Fox, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Richardson and Councillor Street. From the staff this evening, we have the CEO, Mr Stewart, Director of People and Finance, Mr Spinks, Director of Engineering Services, Mr Mackey, Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr Smee, Director of Environment, Development and Community Services, Ms Shakuti, Manager of Environmental Services, Ms Quinn, our Lead Strategic Planner, Mr Stander, our Team Leader, Statutory Planning, Ms Silver, our Planner, Mr Allen, our Bushfire Planning Officer, Mr Salter, our Communications Officer, Mr Heather, and our Executive Assistant, Mrs Morton, with no apologies this evening. Takes us to confirmation of minutes. The motion is that the minutes of the open session of Council Meeting Number 2, held on the 2nd of February 2026, be confirmed as a true record. Looking for a mover and a seconder. I've got a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in the Deputy Mayor. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. Workshops, not what it says on my bit of paper. I know there was a workshop on Tuesday, the 10th of February, in relation to emergency management, Browns Road reconstruction, and the LPS. Declarations of interest. Does anyone have a declaration they'd like to declare? Yep, the CEO.
I'd like to declare an interest in item 21.1 and close session tonight, and I'll leave the room.
Thank you. Anybody else? Thank you very much. Still on page two, is there any item on the agenda that a councillor would like to transfer from open into closed session or closed into open session? No, thank you. Does any member of the public wish to ask a question? If so, please come forward. Just the name and the suburb in which you live. I know most of you know the drill by now, but just a reminder. Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. Peter Creef, Allens Rivulet, and this relates to a question a couple of weeks ago, but I guess it's more about just making sure we understand the information that's coming to us. So we find it interesting that planning had figures, this is in relation to offsets and things. So we find it interesting that planning had figures on how many properties have paid a biodiversity offset. And it was at the fingertips of Councillor Cordover at the time when he asked the question. But we still haven't had any response as to how many properties have had a Part 5 agreement and what was the cumulative value of the biodiversity of those properties prior to going into Part 5. There was no response to that in the agenda, in the minute. So just wondering if we could get some sort of further information about that.
Ms Shakuti.
Yes, and apologies for that oversight. We can provide that information.
Thank you. Any further questions? Please come forward.
Hello, everyone. Nick Booth from Longley.
Just give me a sec. Can Council confirm whether the project manager or special projects manager who had oversight in the underpass and the Kingston Interchange projects, has that program manager been promoted to the project director of the Sports Precinct project, and whether this role was public advertised or only internally, and was it subject to competitive merit-based recruitment process and compliant to the Council's recruitment and probity policies, recruitment and section policy number 9.5?
The CEO.
Thanks for the question. So in terms of the specific roles within the organisation, I won't go into detail about staff members or who's done what in the past. In terms of the recruitment for the project manager for the sports precinct works related to the AFL High Performance Centre, that was an internal expression of interest process that we ran, and there were multiple applicants for that, and a competitive process was run to determine the successful applicant.
Further question?
Can Council give their rationale behind this promotion, given that the report was critical of the oversight of the projects and the importance of the sports precinct of a $100 million-plus project?
The CEO.
In terms of the scope of works, I think it's really important to understand the bigger picture around the way we've structured our work into the work up at the sports precinct. I'll note that $100 million figure relates to the training and administration facility itself, which isn't a council oversight of that project. That's being delivered by the Tasmanian Football Club for their purpose. Our role in that is to provide the land and the enabling works around it. So the overall program governance of that has been built internally with a lot of, I guess, checks and balances around it, and making sure that that all the people working in that program are suitably supported and set up for success.
My question is, the word staged retreat has been bandied about a bit lately. Can you explain what that actually means?
Ms. Shakuri?
In relation to Stylus.
In relation to what? Sorry, I didn't... Stylus. Yeah.
STRLUS, Stylus. Can you...
Stylus.
General submission that you guys are currently submitting. There's a... there's a bit of correspondence there about a staged retreat.
Yep. Ms. Shakuri.
And infrastructure relocation.
Yes, so that is in relation to potential hazard, natural hazards that we are going, as a community and a state and the country, are going to be seeing greater impacts from climate change. Our commentary regarding that is that we already have a number of... Many regional communities that are in these hazard zones, as well as, I suppose, planned areas as well. Even in metropolitan areas, there is going to be impacts. And our commentary about that is around how that is actually going to translate in real life for our communities, and what... if it comes to that, we have to look at potentially retreating our infrastructure in particular that's going to be exposed to these hazards, what the guidance is from the state government in relation to how that will happen, and how our community and council will be, I suppose, supported through that transition. We're seeking greater clarification on the practical translation of that.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Before I state my name and my suburb, I'm just wondering if I can ask a question that's relevant to stating my name and suburb, please.
Sure.
I'm just wondering, is it a requirement that you know what my name is and what my suburb is when I'm being when I'm addressing the council, given that this is live streamed and open to the public, and might breach my privacy.
Yep. Just let us just confirm that.
Yep, thank you.
I can't assist because it's a practice followed for as long.
And just for the record, I actually don't mind. I don't mind, and I'm happy to give it freely. But I just want to ask this question because something came up today in correspondence from a member in this chamber. And every meeting, we get up and we state our name and our address. And that information, or at least, you know, part of that information is available publicly through the Australian Electoral Commission, for example. If I want to find out where you live, I can find that out fairly easily. We get information
really?
From politicians.
I wasn't aware that electoral rolls were open to anybody in the public.
You can search as long as you're an enrolled voter. You can search the electoral roll. And in fact, politicians use that all the time. I get addressed, you know, for example, I've had a Christmas card from a politician before, and I've had a calendar from a politician, and it's distinctly addressed to me. And I'm not a member of that particular party, nor have I corresponded with that a politician in the past, and yet for some reason they're able to address me personally at my address.
So I know that politicians do have special dispensation, if you like, to have access to. They're provided with copies of electoral rolls relevant to their electorate, but no further than that. I wasn't ever aware that anybody could just search an electoral roll.
In actual fact, too, there's information available publicly on the list, for example. So, you know, I've had people access the list for information about where somebody lives before as well that's not related to their job. Yeah.
The CEO.
So under the local government meeting regs, it's not a requirement that questions from the public provide their name and their suburb of occupancy. However, it does provide for council to develop any other procedures as per council requirement to be followed in regard to public question time at ordinary council meetings, and this is a procedure that Canberra Council has adopted.
Yep, and I would understand the reason for that. I think it's natural that if we are going to be discussing stuff that's related to Kingborough Council, that it's probably important that that person lives in Kingborough. But, yeah, so that's fine. I'm happy to state my name and my suburb, though. It's Alison Rogers, and I live in Tinderbox. I did have a question around that data about biodiversity and why those other couple of questions didn't get answered in today's agenda. So I won't prod on that one any further because it's been confirmed that information is going to be provided. So thank you. But I do have a question around a question that I brought up a couple of meetings ago around bushfire risk mitigation and the clearing of fuel loads on people's property. I did ask that whilst there is an information sheet available on the website in relation to that, it all involves filling out a form or checking with other organisations. And my question was, given the nature of our risk in Tasmania, and we're obviously concerned with Kingborough, that we believe that it's important that property owners are being active in the reduction of fuel loads on their properties. And so my question was, what can we actually do without having to fill in forms and apply for permits and run the risk of being penalised or fined? In relation to that, because there is some confusion. So some people think that they can pick up dead bark and sticks and things on their property and that that's perfectly okay. However, there is other information out there which may not be true and may be misleading, but some other people have said, oh no, you can't do that because you're disturbing habitat, for example. And okay. So we just want to know, can, sure. And I'll use my property as an example.
No, that's all right. I've got the gist of the question. Yep. Thank you. My understanding was from the discussions that we'd had previously in the Chamber and also when we had the forum that some of us came to a couple of weeks ago, that you were keen to see a resource developed that would be, you know, a quick checklist reference that property owners could look at so that it was very clear to them, yes, you can pick up sticks, you can pick up bark, you can do this, you can do that. And my understanding was that we'd given a commitment that we were working towards that, but Ms. Shakuti might like to provide some further advice.
Thank you. Yes, that's correct. So we are working on more information and we also offer and we'll have more information about how to do it, I suppose a free assessment for people. So it's not an application, it's a free assessment, and that is, I suppose, more tailored to your particular situation, noting that people's properties are in different areas, have different infrastructure on it, etc. So yes, we are working on that and hopefully we'll have something out very soon.
Okay, thank you. So just further on that then, at this stage your advice would be, even though I can identify, for example, at the front of my property that fronts Tinderbox Road, that there is a very distinct fire hazard in terms of dead limbs, dead bark, and some of that is created when your slashers go through. So on our road, your slashers go through and they go and trim off all the trees, and that all just falls to the ground. Can I pick all of that up, or is your advice that you need to leave that alone until I've got further advice from council?
Ms. Shakuti.
In terms of the stuff that has been cut and fallen to the ground, yes, you can pick that up.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions, please come forward.
Charlie Biggins, Charlie's Tree Service. Leslie Bale. I have some questions this evening regarding Council's biodiversity offset policy and how it applies to the provisions within the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme 2015 for the protection of priority vegetation. Within this municipality, as you are all aware, Kingborough Council has had a formal offset policy for the last 10 years and has been collecting offsets since 2001. The current policy was amended by the previous council in 2022, and the sitting councillors unanimously voted in favour of its incorporation into the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme in the beginning of 2024. As everyone in this room is very familiar with the offset policy and voted again two meetings ago that a review of the current could wait until after this year's council election, there should be no problem with answering a few questions that arose today after inspecting trees at a local school involved in a development application. We also heard from Ms. Quinn at council meeting on January 2026, and council applies a market-based approach to offsetting. So please hold those market-based principles front and centre while considering the following questions. Could council please explain when biodiversity first becomes materially present on an otherwise vacant block of land, and is a council permit or Part 5 agreement required for the cultivation of any high conservation values or priority vegetation?
Ms. Quinn.
A permit, do you mean in terms of cultivation, growing native plants on a vacant lot of land?
More importantly, the first part of the question, could Council please explain when biodiversity first becomes materially present on an otherwise vacant block?
Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so in relation to the triggers for the biodiversity offset policy, to clarify that, they are within that policy and they relate to a certain size. So there's a list of what those values are, the type of trees that they are or the type of vegetation communities or wildlife, and it lists what size they need to be, what diameter at 1.4 metres above the ground that tree needs to be to qualify for acquiring an offset. So people can check the biodiversity offset policy for those triggers. Yep, you have it.
Another question?
Low priority vegetation, all other vegetation communities. Doesn't specify a size.
So if we're talking about, it's hard to know without knowing the specific site you're talking about, but I was assuming you were talking about
within,
trees that are grown.
Within the policy, there is table 2 and table 3. Yes, this specifies sizes for very high priority, but we're claiming a one-to-one ratio for low priority vegetation values. There's no size.
Sorry, I've
misunderstood
you. So there's size in relation to trees, in relation to your biodiversity values. It's in relation to their conservation status. So whether they're listed as threatened, rare, vulnerable, endangered, under the Nature Conservation Act and the EPBC.
So to go back to the question, could you please explain when biodiversity first becomes materially present on an otherwise vacant block?
I think that's a really, really difficult question to answer without looking at a piece of vegetation. So for vegetation to become a
community... Does it start as a seed?
Sorry, Mr. Biggins, can you just please let Ms. Quinn... Thank you. You've had your three questions now. Please let Ms. Quinn finish.
Native vegetation, individual native plants to become a vegetation community, they have to meet the requirements of that vegetation community classification, which the state government set through the TasVeg program. So it can't just be one plant or two plants. It needs to meet the classification of a vegetation community. There are probably over 90 vegetation communities classified within Tasmania by the state government, and they're all given a rating of whether they're common or whether they're threatened or not, and the low, medium and high biodiversity value relates to how threatened they are. So something that's low is something that's much more common.
Okay, my second question. Given that council permission was not required...
Mr. Biggins, you've actually had three questions. I'll allow this last one because you've repeated a question, but then that's you've had your three questions.
Given that council permission was not required for the planting of tree seedlings on private land 30 years ago, was the landowner entitled to any stewardship payments from council's Environment Fund for the ongoing protection and cultivation of biodiversities throughout the life of what is now being assessed as high conservation or priority vegetation? The landholder has received no financial assistance directed towards the establishment and upkeep of what is now being classified as high conservation value trees. Why does the removal of the same vegetation 30 years later result in a material loss to the landowner as offsets when in fact the municipality has benefited from 30 years of high conservation assets within the landscape at zero cost to the council or the municipality?
Ms. Quinn.
Biodiversity values in Kingborough, as we know, are really high. They're high on a state level, they're considered high on a national level. And because of that, Kingborough Council has endorsed several policies, as does the state through the planning scheme, that protect those values. They're considered important and critical to the biodiversity of Australia. Offsetting, people, landowners have native vegetation on their property, whether it's been there before they bought it, whether it was there when they first, whether they planted it or not. It doesn't matter if they planted it or if it was there before them or if it's always been there. It still has biodiversity value. And offsetting, as you know, is one mechanism that we have, that we use at Kingborough Council to protect that biodiversity, and where it can't be protected, it mitigates the loss by providing an offset.
Thank you, Mr. Biggins. Is there anybody else have a question? Please come forward. Thank you.
Hi, Tamika Adkins, Oyster Cove. So Tasmania is unique in requiring regional land use plans to reference community strategies. How are community strategies developed?
Mishkudi? No, Mr. Stander?
Apologies. Can I have some more specification as to what community strategy you're referring to? Is it a council strategic plan or a different one that you are?
Yes, any community strategy that needs to be built. So, as I said, Tasmania is unique in requiring regional land use plans. So they reference community strategy. I'm just wondering how a community strategy is developed.
Ms. Shakuti.
Thank you. I can talk about our most recent strategic plan, which is probably the most relevant community strategy, and CEO and the Director of Governance can, if I get the process not quite right, they might be able to assist me. So essentially the way that that was developed is that there was consultation with our elected members, there was consultation conducted with the community, and there was also consultation with our staff, as they, many of our staff have worked in Kingborough and that council for a number of years and have some really good insights into community needs. And then those themes and suggestions and values were collated over a series of workshops and I suppose the draft sort of reviewed at those workshops multiple occasions until a final strategy was developed, which then came to our chambers and it was voted on and endorsed by councillors.
Further question?
Yes. So the Greater Hobart City Plan references Australis. Get that right?
Yep.
What local land use strategy did the nomination of 28% as LCZ and an equivalent area under the SAPs specifically reference?
Mr. Stander.
Maybe I'll take a step back to answer that question. Look, the way the planning system is set out in Tasmania is obviously you've got your policies, and so recently the Tasmanian regional policies were introduced, and then you've got your regional plans. We're still operating under the current Southern Tasmania regional land use strategy, and how that work will flow into the planning schemes. It does not stipulate the percentage of properties that needs to go to a specific zone. It provides more holistic and a broad scale approach to things that should be protected or things that should be encouraged. So it does not provide that level of detail that you would expect. You will note there's a report on the agenda tonight, and I know we're not supposed to talk about those items, but I'm going to say cheeky by indicating that it's something that we in a way, would like to see through the regional strategies. And you'll see council submission on the recommendation is that we seek to see more, I guess, articulation around that and, you know, the expectations, particularly for regional and rural areas. So there's the strategy talks about that, but it's extremely high level. It doesn't go down to percentages.
Our final question is around Part 5 agreements and overlays. So if a zone is changed, so we go through some rezoning, whatever the outcome may be, and you have an overlay or overlays, as it's more sort of predominant, on your property, those overlays will generally carry over with the information that I've researched. With a Part 5 agreement, if a Part 5 agreement will also carry over, so my question is, Part 5 agreement is there for protection of a particular section of land. Is that considered the same as an overlay on my property?
Mr. Stander.
Good question. It's a very technical question, and it's something that the Commission is exploring through the hearing process. So they haven't provided opinion on that, and I do realise there's lots of different opinions about Part 5 agreements and its interrelation with zoning as well as overlays. I'll give you a simple answer. Part 5 agreements got a specific purpose for specific land, where overlays are more spatially. It's often an area covering multiple properties and it's got a different purpose. So for instance, a flood overlay is essentially a mechanism that the planning authority can utilise to say we need to look at a property in more detail. So it's more a trigger point than anything else, where a covenant is actually quite explicit of what it is trying to protect or manage and so forth. So they're two different mechanisms and they often work together. But it is quite complex in terms of how people view that, because sometimes the covenant can be utilised to address a broader issue, and sometimes it simply doesn't go to the detail that it needs to go.
Sure, please. Thank you. So if I only have a Part 5 agreement and I don't have an overlay, does that mean that that's the only area on my portion of land that needs protecting?
Mr. Stander.
Good question. I would say we don't know. We don't know. I think once it gets down to the detail of the property, overlay, like once I said, it is so broad. Often you have to go and look at a site to actually determine whether it is appropriate to investigate further. The priority vegetation overlay is one of those overlays. It is a broad scale mapping, but often if you go on the site, you'll find a different scenario. I don't think it's that simplistic, but I understand where you're coming from the question, and it's something that the Commission is exploring as part of the LPS hearings.
Thank you. Any further questions, please come forward. All right, we'll move on then. Thank you very much for your questions. Takes us to still page 2. We're on questions on notice in the public. There were 3. They've all been responded to by Ms. Shakuti. The first one was in relation to biodiversity offsets by Ms. Knight. Second one from Ms. Groves in relation to Section 35G statement. And the final one on the tree bylaw consultation from Mr. Booth. We're now on page 10, questions without notice from councillors. Does any councillor have a question? Councillor Bain, and then Councillor Midgley, and then Councillor Antoli, and then Councillor Cordova. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. I've had some Huntingfield residents contact me in relation to a possible pathway between Huntingfield and the Park and Ride. So within the current year's budget, we have a budget allocation to design a pathway between Sirius Drive in Huntingfield and the Park and Ride. So my question is, can we just receive an update on how the design work is progressing, and will the results of the design work form part of the upcoming 26-27 budget discussions?
Mr. Mackey, thank heavens you're here.
Thank you, Mayor. thank you for the question. I can confirm that the survey has been completed for the design work on that project. We're expecting the project design to be completed by about April, and it will be considered as part of the 26-27 capital budget process.
thank you. I think everyone needs to speak up a bit tonight because it's not as loud. I don't know whether Mr. Heather is, there's anything you can do to... I'm just straining a couple of times to hear everyone, so we might need to move our microphones in a little bit closer and just use our big parent voices. If we could all do that, because if I'm struggling to hear, I imagine that the people in the public gallery can't hear us very well, and I know a couple of councillors have indicated that they can't hear. So, big parent voices, please. Councillor Bain, did you have another question? No. Councillor Midgley, the question. In a big parent voice.
I was waiting for the pause and then going to breathe in and practice my big parent voice. Haven't used that for a while, though. They don't listen now. I have a question that's come from community regarding bus stops. And as we know, especially across our rural areas and all across Kingborough, we've got so many bus stops, and I always feel sad for people having to stand in the rain or the hot sun. A couple of years ago, the state government did a bus stop relocation and upgrade installation project. They could have made it a bit shorter, but anyway, probably had more words. And as part of that, they found a lot of bus stops that needed upgrading, and then they had to look at the whole DDA compliance around that. I know that then they chose a couple of bus stops to do across Kingborough. I guess what I'm wanting to know is, have they all been completed, the ones that were in that budget? There was a long list of others. Is there any plan for future upgrades? And, yeah, any intel around that, please?
Yeah, so you're right. I'll refer to Mr. Mackey, but they did an audit of every bus stop in Kingborough, and I can't remember how many we had. I think it was over 100 from memory. Might even be more. It predates Mr. Mackey being here, but I'm hoping he's across the issue.
Thank you, Mayor. I don't have more detail in terms of the numbers. It predates me being here, but I do understand there is another tranche that have been in the process of being designed. And will be in terms of the shelters and the DDA compliance. Don't have the details on that, but I'll commit to getting the details back to you.
So I think from memory, just to add to that, I think that they identified the top ones to complete in the first lot of funding. I think it was around $3 million of funding from recollection that we specifically got as part of maybe the city deal. I can't quite recollect that. But that was far more than any other municipality received. And as part of that, they did go through and prioritise them based on the usage of the bus stops, so the number of people that were actually using them every day and what, particularly they started an assessment based on the level of usage plus the accessibility of the bus stop. They were sort of the top two considerations, and there were quite a lot completed from memory. There were at least 20 completed, I believe, but I know that it was certainly never going to do all of them, and there are still many more to do, and they did come across some obstacles with some of them. There's one in Taroona on the Channel Highway, I think it's bus stop 36, and there was a power pole in the way, and there was no way that we could make that bus stop totally accessible by a wheelchair or a pram or anything like that because of it's a very odd location it's been built on. It's been built at the end of a road, and it was a historic thing, but a lot of them they've done significant improvements to in terms of the accessibility because the buses are now all fully wheelchair accessible as well. But we will get more detail. Next, we had Councillor Antoli and then Councillor Cordova.
Thank you very much, Mayor. I have a question regarding the proposed Drew Point Dog Obedience Park that we've been discussing at council level. I've heard a rumour this week that unfortunately that land has become unavailable due to Taswater opposing the development or the opportunity there. Could we get some clarity on that? Because when the news came to my ears, it was news to my ears and a couple of other councillors. And what is the status? And the rumour is that other land around Leslie Vale or other opportunities are being looked at, with the dog obedience community feeling it's a disappointment way too far. So could we get an update for
Mr. Smith, can you help us with that one?
It's not the case that Taswater have opposed, but it is the case that We have been unable to date to reach agreement in relation to the use of that land in terms of the terms and conditions. Given the time pressures associated with the AFL High Performance Centre project, we have looked at alternate options, one of which has been discussed with the Obedience Club, and I think it's fair to say they have a reasonably high level of interest in pursuing that option as an alternate, but those negotiations are still currently ongoing.
Councillor Antoli.
Thanks, and if I may, is it possible to come to an agreement with TAS Water in the long term so that any interim step is might be temporary, or do the Obedience Park community or organisation feel that what you're looking at might be a better fit for them?
Mr. Smee.
We'll take feedback from the club in relation to whether it's an interim step or whether it's the longer term option. Councils would be aware that as part of our sport and rec strategy, we had an interest in the site at Drew Point for public recreation purposes, and we'll continue to pursue the use of that land irrespective of the decision of the Obedience Club. But as I said, we'll continue to liaise with them in relation to this as a short or long-term option.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. And are you able to share what the sticking point is with TAS Water?
It's the price. It's the price that they're asking.
Right. So they're always asking a price. I wasn't aware of that, by the way.
Yeah. Significant.
Okay. All right. That's a very important sticking point. Thank you for clarifying that.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. My question relates to the waste strategy and our WasteWise events guide and Council's activities, specifically in relation to takeaway coffee cups. So I realise that there's been community interest around reducing the number of takeaway coffee cups that are in use. It's something like 1.8 billion cups discarded annually in Australia, and I realise that our WasteWise events guidelines have some discussion around what we can do. My specific question was raised by a community member. There seems to be like a disparity between how some cafe owners encourage people to use keep cups and things, whereas others don't so much. So I was just interested to know how is Council kind of leaning in, working with business owners to try and see what we can do to help get more keep cups and things like that.
Ms. Shakuti, you like a cup of coffee, don't you? You can help us with this one then.
Indeed. It's a really good question. Our guidelines relate to our events. However, I acknowledge that, across the municipality and in all communities, it's always better to be discouraging using single-use packaging or food packaging. So at this point of in time, to be honest, we're not engaging in that space. We are working on developing a new waste strategy, which will have some, broader community components in terms of education, advocacy, etc. So that might be something that we consider in the development of that, amongst all the other different actions that we could put in place.
Councillor Midgley, do you have another question?
I have a question for closed session.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? If not, we'll continue. Page four, questions on notice from councillors. At the time the agenda was compiled, there were no questions on notice from councillors. Open session of council now adjourns at 6:13 p.m. and planning authority commences at 6:13 p.m. We're on page five, development application for change of use to visitor accommodation at Unit 9, 9 Maranoa Road in Kingston, with a recommendation on page 15. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. I've got a mover in the Deputy Mayor and a seconder in Councillor Bain. Deputy Mayor.
Thank you. So this proposal involves a change of use of one of the strata lots within a 27-lot strata scheme from residential use to visitor accommodation. Understandably, the other people who are living at this this collection of properties are a little bit concerned about the change of use. It's reflected in the 8 representations that we received. One of those representations included... it was on behalf of 11 of the owners from 16 of the dwellings. So there's obviously some concern about changing from residential to visitor accommodation and what that means. They've raised lots of very valid points and things that I can completely appreciate and understand where they're coming from. It seems, though, unfortunately, that the planning scheme is not the relevant way to enforce the what could be used at this collection of properties. The report goes through and explains quite clearly why the proposal meets all of the requirements of the scheme, and my understanding is that it's the body corporate that should be used to regulate the change of use in the future if they so desire. So from my reading of the report, I'm comfortable that everything has been addressed. It's unfortunate for those property owners, but maybe they can look at their body corporate structure and how they can regulate the change of use in the future. So I'm happy to support the recommendation.
Further contributions or questions? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I want to thank Mr. Allen, the author of the report. It's really thorough. I believe he's new to us, so welcome to the team. It's good to see you. I really like the way... One of the things that are important for me as a councillor is to read what the council's responses are to the objections. There's so much you can learn, and it's something that I definitely encourage people to learn from as well, because we all have these assumptions, hurts, fears, and they just don't fall, as valid as they are, they just don't fall within the planning scheme sometimes, and we've got to dispassionately, or we should dispassionately, apply the scheme to the circumstance. It's a tough one. Obviously there were quite a number of representations opposing. I think the responses are great. I do support the recommendation. I'm actually glad there's a little bit of extra holiday accommodation becoming available. I know it upsets some people when you're in a strata setup, but this is the nature of living in a free market economy, and we're grateful for it and we need it, and we'll probably be needing more of it as we develop our high performance centres, plural, at the Kingborough Sports Centre. So happy to support. I want to thank the planning team for their thorough report.
Thank you. Further contributions, Councillor Midgley and then Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I would like to say that we probably need more accommodation for people, long-term accommodation for people in Kingborough. I know I've counted so many people who at the moment cannot get a rental, cannot get a home, a stable home to live in, are having to move out of their home tomorrow and they've got nowhere to go. That number is increasing and it's crossing so many different socioeconomic status. But that falls outside of this conversation, but I wanted to say that tonight, and I know that there has not been any move from the state government in regards to whole home, Airbnb, short stay accommodation, no movement, no one's been brave enough to have a look at that. I think they're still probably having working groups around it, but it's definitely a complexity of part of the housing crisis that we are in. A question that I have is in regards to 2.5.3. One of the members of the public, the question regarding the conversion of complex to short stay, approving one unit could lead to more short stay applications, changing the whole character of the complex, and the staff response. And yes, I also like to thank the staff for the reports, really easy to understand, and thank you very much for that information. And the response is, any change of use from residential to visitor accommodation will require a planning permit and will be assessed on its own merits. So could that mean that this whole strata development could be visitor accommodation? Is there a limit to this? Is it sort of first in, best dress? This one gets approved but others don't? I guess we can't really answer that without looking at each separate. But, yeah, do we have any kind of guidelines in regards to that, or is it, again, part of the body corporate matter?
Mr. Allen.
Yes, a planning permit could be sought for one, you know, one of the other 27. Certainly could be something that could be done in the future. There is also exemption criteria that relates to, home sharing exemption under PD6. So that's also something else that might be something that's possible. Cumulative impacts are also a consideration. It's very case by case. Certainly that's something that's considered. But where that threshold is, that it becomes highly problematic is I guess part of an ongoing consideration. That's case by case. Yeah.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. A question, Mayor. This question is about, so I'm looking now at page 9, and there's a reference here to a TASCAT decision, G. Beatty versus King Island, and it talks about having regard to sub-items A through F does not require that each matter be satisfied as a standalone or mandatory test. And so I'm just seeking clarification. My understanding here is that the key discretion here is within Planning Directive Number 6, Clause 3.1E, P2, and throughout tonight's discussion, I'm sure we'll be talking about PD6 a lot. So when we talk about the Planning Directive Number 6, we're talking about PD6. And my question is really, is basically what it's saying there on page 9, that as a planning authority, we don't have to say that, we don't have to find that every single sub-item of A through F fails in order to say that this does not meet the planning scheme. Rather, as it says, and this is the quote within the officer's report, rather it requires a balanced planning assessment in which each consideration is weighted according to its relevance and significance in the circumstances of the specific proposal. So my question is, am I understanding that correctly, that of the A through F, which is the privacy of residents, any likely increase in noise, the residential function of the strata scheme, and so on and so on, it's not that we have to find that every single one of them doesn't meet the planning scheme, it's that any of those with relation to the weight and consideration of this particular site. Is my interpretation broadly correct?
Yes, Mr. Allen.
Sorry, apologies. Yes, I'd say that's certainly an accurate assessment. Yeah, the way that it goes is it gives us the consideration, which is the residential amenity, and then it gives us a series of sub-items after that, which would include things like privacy, layout, that sort of thing. And the way that it's laid out is it says having regard to the following sub-items. So, yes, you're correct that you would look at each one and create a balanced assessment overall. So it does consider that there would be impacts, and impacts is something that might be anticipated, but not necessarily that impacts. Impacts in and of themselves are to be expected, I guess. And yeah, you are having regard to the following sub clauses.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. That's helpful. Second question is about the other precedent that was mentioned, a TASCAT decision relating to Rich Tapestry versus Hobart City Council, which was a site in Sandy Bay, and I took a look at that, and in that particular case, there was very limited, if any, I think it said something along the lines of the only shared areas were a small amount of garden and something else. Can you just take us through how, like, why was Rich Tapestry used as an example when, in this particular case, there are really extensive shared accessways and shared driveways? So I'm trying to understand why was Rich Tapestry versus Hobart City Council used in this report, when it explicitly said there were very few shared areas in that Sandy Bay location, whereas there's heaps of shared areas in this location.
Mr. Allen.
I guess one of the key items, as far as the Rich Tapestry one goes, is you're looking at residential impacts on the amenity in a strata complex that has four units, and you know it starts with two, a third then applies to go, you know, in addition. And so when you're talking about the residential function overall, I guess that's why it sort of illustrates, because a lot of people are generally concerned about cumulative impacts. And so I guess in this case, when you're talking about two going to three or four, as opposed to one of 27 separate lots, that's where a lot of the value of that one goes in. And certainly there are a number of times throughout that where they affirm the particular way that the clause is written and the way that it's interpreted. So it can be helpful in a few different respects, yeah.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. So the key here is that, and this is my third question, that we're talking about Is there any unreasonable loss of residential amenity to long-term residents? And we've established that in that G. Beatty example, we've established that it wasn't... I'll just try and frame this as the correct question. If... residential function is going to be the key question here. Even if it's only one that's changing to visitor accommodation, couldn't it be the case that residential function will still be changed? Is it about just the sheer number of visitor accommodations in a strata complex, or are there other patterns of behaviour that might result in unacceptable loss of residential amenity?
Ms. Silver.
I guess the question is, what is unreasonable? And in this instance, because it is a large strata and units, as you know, through their residential nature, are designed to ensure privacy between residents, and they have their own car spot, they don't create any extra parking demand, they have their own private open space areas. So, and everyone would give you a different answer, really, but it's the unreasonable impacts on amenity that's what we need to consider. And it's not black and white with visitor accommodation, so it's a difficult one to answer. But in this instance, because it is only one, and other ones would be subject to planning consideration as well, it might be that the answer's different for the second one. But it was difficult to argue that it's unreasonable in that complex.
Councillor Cordova.
Final question is just about the placing within these 27 units, because I drove in there yesterday and you've got to go straight ahead, then you've got to go left, and then you've got to go right, and the one we're talking about is the one in the middle, and they all have very little signs, and some of the parking spaces you're allowed to park there and other parking spaces are for turning only. Little signs tell you where to go. I can see wayfinding-wise very easy to accidentally go straight ahead and you're at number 14, or turn right, you're at number 27. Imagine doing that after dark. So the question is it the case that wayfinding could... I'll frame it this way. Is it the case that if this particular option if this particular proposal was, say, at the front on the streetscape, that it would be a different level of loss of amenity than if it were where it is, which is in the very back corner, so you have to navigate through all these shared driveways to get to where it is? Does that question make sense? That the fact that it's in the very back left-hand corner of the complex, does that change the amount of residential amenity loss? As opposed to if it was, say, on the streetscape or straight up in the driveway on the main drive?
Ms. Silver.
I don't believe so, because, I don't know whether other people have stayed in a strata visitor accommodation before, but I've always received instructions before I've, first visit the site, and instructions to show you how to get to the car park, and sometimes it is a bit difficult to find where you are parking, but it'll just be that first, in my opinion, time that you visit, and then you'd know what bay you're going to. So it's that question about what's unreasonable again. And because the intensity is low for a small unit, it's reasonable to expect that it would be a small group that would stay there just because of the capacity. So in our opinion, that residential amenity wouldn't be different. It might be just a little bit of wayfinding at the beginning, but then it would be fine. Yeah.
Councillor Cordova.
I'll race through my contribution. I've thought long and hard about this one, as you can probably tell. I think we're on very solid ground, and I've put down some dot points for an alternative motion should this motion not get up. For refusal, and I think we're on very solid ground with TASCAT on this one. My central disagreement, remember that we don't have to prove that it doesn't meet all of them, we only have to prove that it doesn't meet privacy, noise and residential function. And amenity is not just about the physical change in the site. So when I drove through there, the idea that is within the officer's report is that these shared spaces are just transitional corridors, that they're not about shared spaces, they're just places that you pass through. I was there and there's children's scooters and there's shoes and there's small plants. If you can't get through to that lot without crawling past everybody else's house. And after dark, it is going to be headlight beams shining through people's houses. It is going to be people having to do complex three-point turns in a difficult wayfinding setting. So I think where the officer's report talks a lot about privacy isn't being compromised because there's no overlooking, I would say that privacy is much more complex than just simply overlooking. Privacy is, what about the pattern of behaviour? Car doors slamming, wheelie suitcases, somebody not being able to open the key box and trying to get in and calling the landlord at 11 at night. The pattern of behaviour is different with visitor accommodation than it is with general residential. And the fact that there will be more beginning and ending trips with visitor accommodation necessarily means that if it were true that G. Beatty talks about the function, residential function is the same with visitor accommodation and general residential. Well, if that were true, the fact is this will be many more trips because it's basically like having a new resident every single day. So that's why I think we're on really solid ground to say the fact that this particular location at number 9 is straight up, then to the left, then to the right, and then in the middle, it means that necessarily people are going to have a very hard time finding it. And when they do find it, they're going to spend a long time trying to navigate their way to not hit the other cars doing three-point turns. Regular people who are long-term residents have a predictable standard of they'll go to work at a certain time, they'll come home at a certain time. It's very predictable. Whereas necessarily with short-stay accommodation, it is not predictable. And I think privacy is much more than just somebody overlooking you. Privacy is about when you've been a long-term resident and you know your neighbours, and then all of a sudden now you have a bunch of strangers there every single day. So that's a core point about why I think it fails the privacy test on this occasion, is you're going from a situation where there are no other short-stay accommodations and you're putting one in. Whereas in that situation in Sandy Bay, there were already 3 short-stay accommodations and they were just adding an extra one. So I personally think we're on really solid ground here to say that because the pattern of behaviour of short-stay accommodation is different from general residential, and even if it were the same, it's happening at such a frequency that it will break the pattern that these long-term residents are used to. It will break their residential amenity and it would be an unreasonable loss. It infringes upon their privacy, it increases their amount of noise, and the situation of where this particular lot is, I almost think you couldn't find, there's probably 4 units within that 27-unit complex which would be as bad, but this is easily one of the top 4 worst places to choose visitor accommodation because of how difficult the wayfinding is. These are identical shared access driveways with identical units, and in order to get to the one where you've booked, you have to go through this maze. More importantly, I think in terms of loss of residential amenity, the idea that the private management can set some rules, and they talk about this, they say, oh, we're going to set up, we're going to ask the visitors to kindly be quiet on entrance and exit. How is that going to be enforced? That is going to be a burden that is placed on the long-term residents to monitor and enforce that by registering their complaints. And that in itself is an impact on residential amenity. You take these 27 households who never had to worry about this before, and then you say all of a sudden, well, if somebody arrives late or breaks the rules or makes too much noise or has to call the landlord late at night and makes a ruckus, well, then it's on you to report that. Well, that in itself is a change and a loss of residential amenity that I find unreasonable. This is a place where 27 households have lived in a strata complex that has never had this type of intensification of use before, and they shouldn't be unreasonably foisted onto having to deal with that change in pattern of behaviour. So I think on privacy and noise and on residential function, I think we're on very solid ground to refuse this application because it's an inappropriate site for visitor accommodation. Thanks.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Any further contributions? Councillor Richardson, is that a move towards wanting to speak?
Yeah.
Yep. Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. Look, I just wanted to add my voice and say thank you to the staff for the comprehensive report. I think it's a fair, reasonable and balanced approach, and I'm all for it. Thank you.
Any further contributions? I've just got a question, just in relation to the strata or the body corporate versus the planning scheme. I'm aware that there are other multi-unit developments around where their body corporate rules say that
there can be no short stay accommodation. Unfortunately for this group of units, that appears not to have been the case for their situation. And it's obvious through the discussion that, you know, any number of the other units could apply without that change, I guess, to the body corporate rules. Any other units in this area could apply for the planning change of use. If that occurs, but meanwhile, say it occurs 6 months down the track, but in the meanwhile, the body corporate have had an AGM and voted that there would be no other short stay accommodation. How do we know whether a body corporate, if an application is put in for change of use, do we make sure that we check that the body corporate doesn't have a rule against short stay accommodation?
It's outside the scope of the planning assessment. So they might get their planning approval, but then they'll be refused at the body corporate level.
But what if they don't tell the body corporate?
Then it would be enforceable under the body corporate.
So then it's something that they would have to deal with.
Yeah. Okay. But just looking at the tribunal decision for Sir Rich Tapestry, I do notice that Hobart City Council have some guidance about visitor accommodation, and one of the conditions that they say may be applied is a visitor management plan, and that could be a condition if it appeases the councillors, be an extra condition that we can apply to the permit. So basically, the visitor management plan sets out certain requirements, which would be, you know, where they can park, who can be contacted if there are complaints, so details of who will actively manage the property, the maximum number of guests, the maximum number of vehicles. I mean, this is just an example of a template that it could be based on. And then specific requirements, for example, the property must be used in a way that is respectful of the residential setting of the property. The online guests must receive instructions of how to access the parking bays, especially if it's a little bit difficult to find. And that would form part of the condition of the permit, and that visitor plan would need to be available to the future guests. The only issue is who would enforce that in the event that there were complaints. So in the first instance, that'd go through to the person managing the site. But in the second instance, it might be that council get the complaints, and is that something that we want to be enforcing, and do we have the resources for that? So that's a question as well. Because there's such a question around amenity, it's hard to answer, but it might be make the residents feel better if something like that was conditioned as part of the approval rather than a refusal.
Councillor Cordova, question?
I thought about this quite long and hard, and my question is, my understanding was that P2 is a use standard, and so therefore it's a planning scheme requirement to assess against this, whereas relying on private management to just do it, that doesn't kind of meet the use standard, in my opinion, because I made that point that asking the local residents... So here's the question. Asking... No, I'm ready for the question.
Okay.
If you're asking residents to enforce it, isn't that a residential amenity impact in itself? If you're asking the local residents that it's up to them to contact the council if somebody's making too much noise, isn't that a change in their residential amenity by forcing them to make the complaint? They have to bear the burden. Isn't that a change in residential amenity?
Ms. Silver.
It's based on the assumption that there will be complaints, but there might not be any complaints. So it's kind of, anticipating that the use will be not managed appropriately and will cause an unreasonable, impact on the residents that are there. And it's a bit of a difficult one because visitor accommodation is a bit grey, and the definition of amenity is a little bit grey, and everyone would have a different opinion. And it's not fair for the residents to enforce it, but through a condition of the permit that provides clear details of who to contact in the event there is a problem, at least they'll have some clear direction of how to you know, respond to issues on the site, and then noting that they, those complaints, I mean, I'm not really sure how it's all managed because it's outside of the planning scheme, but it might be that those visitor accommodation units that are registered with like Stays or Booking.com, the complaints might escalate, but I'm not quite sure. So it's a little bit grey to those booking companies, and maybe there's action that way, but it is a little bit unclear. The best that we could do from a planning perspective would be to condition a visitor management plan. I don't see how else it can be managed if the body corporate don't enforce it on this specific site, and all the body corporates are different as well, and it's just outside of the realm of our assessment. So it's not something that we would look at normally, but I understand your concerns for sure.
But if I heard you right, you were suggesting that perhaps we could add a condition to the permit, which is that the document be a condition of the change of use that a document is provided to all visitors using the accommodation that outlines the parking arrangements, etc., etc. If we can put that into some words, that would be.
So I don't know how to go about this, whether we propose a draft condition and that gets circulated to the councillors. I'm not quite sure how.
No, we can just, if we can come up with the words, Mrs. Morton puts it on the screen magically.
So prior to the commencement of the improved
Mrs. Morton, could you?
Maybe give it to Amanda.
Yeah, okay.
It would go in as a number 5. Just bear with us while we do this. Just waiting for the words, yeah.
It's a lot more than I was thinking. Okay. So we've now got a new point five, and given the size of it, I'm going to read it out so that everyone's aware of it, and then I will ask the mover and the seconder of the motion if they are happy with it. So it reads, point five, prior to the commencement of the approved use, a management plan for the operation of a visitor accommodation must be submitted and approved as a condition endorsement to the satisfaction of the manager development services. A management plan must include measures to limit, manage and mitigate unreasonable impacts upon the amenity of long-term residents. These measures must include, but are not limited to, the following requirements. A, to limit, manage and mitigate noise generated as a result of the visitor accommodation. B, to limit, manage and mitigate behaviour issues caused as a result of the visitor accommodation. C, to maintain the security of the building where the visitor accommodation would be located, including managing and or limiting access to shared areas and facilities. D, to specify the maximum permitted occupancy of the visitor accommodation. E, to specify that if guests utilise the site for the parking of vehicles, the maximum number of vehicles to be parked on the site is one, and detail where the designated parking space is located and how the space is to be accessed. Additionally, at the booking stage, guests should be discouraged from bringing more than one vehicle and be advised that the site is constrained and shared with a number of other users, and to take care not to park in any other space or part of the site not allocated for the booking. And F, to provide a name and contact phone number of a person who will respond to any complaints regarding behaviour of guests. If the property is sold, the visitor accommodation management plan must be updated with new contact details. Once approved, the management plan must be implemented prior to the commencement of the approved use and must be maintained for as long as the visitor accommodation is in operation. The VAMP must be provided to adjacent property owners and occupiers within 14 days of being approved. If the property is sold, the updated VAMP, in accordance with subclause F above, must be provided to adjacent property owners and occupiers within 10 business days of settlement. That is the amendment. I'm wanting to know from the Deputy Mayor who moved it and Councillor Bain who seconded it whether the amendment is acceptable. Deputy Mayor?
Yeah.
Thank you. Councillor Bain?
Can I ask a question?
No. You can if it's going to help frame your answer.
Just a question around the parking, limiting it to one. Does the existing residents have an allowance for two spaces?
Ms. Silva?
Yeah, there's only one there because it's a really old strata. Yeah.
You're happy? Okay, so that point five now becomes part of the substantive motion. Is there anybody who has not spoken who would like to ask a question? I've got Councillor Fox and Councillor Street. Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. I guess I'm looking at the page six where there's a diagram of the layout of these units. And Councillor Cordova has kindly explained to me that the location of this particular unit is in probably the worst possible position for access for people who aren't familiar with the site. It's in very small print, but it's the entryway, if you turn left immediately, it's right at the very end of that line of straight ahead. It's the centre unit in amongst three. So you could, there is no indication on the road or on the internal driveways where the driveways are and how far they go, and I understand going in there it's like an absolute maze, and I'm just wondering why have they chosen that particular unit to turn into visitor accommodation when any of the other units would have been a much better choice.
So I suspect it's because they're all independently owned, and the owner of that particular unit has decided to turn it into visitor accommodation rather than long-term rental.
Based on that question, I would oppose the motion. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further? Oh, Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. Look, the reason that I've chosen to speak in relation to this motion is the addition of the last condition. I have some difficulty with the extent that it goes to, and I wonder whether some of the matters included therein effectively have the effect, that's terrible English, but it's what I mean, effectively have the effect of devolving what is otherwise the decision of this planning authority onto the manager of development services in their discretion. And I don't cast any aspersions on the holder or otherwise of that title for the time being or in future, just that it seems to me that it is a delegation of the planning authority's power to approve or reject this this application by way of requiring the visitor management plan and the extent of it. Having said all of that, I'm reading the room and that there is a desire to continue with that condition, and I wouldn't want it to be the reason that this matter is lost. I'm just wondering if Ms. Morton can scroll up briefly to the beginning of the motion. Sorry, down. It's been a long day. Just to the start of five, which may have already been on the screen.
It was.
I'm sorry.
But that's okay,
I'm
because
sorry.
Now we're all cross-eyed.
Yeah. So there is an addition which I will move, which would assist me with accepting the motion as amended, and that is an amendment that after the words manager development services in the first sentence, the words with such approval not to be unreasonably withheld.
Spoken like a true lawyer.
I would love to be able to say that it was me that came up with it, but Councillor Richardson and I have been having a brief discussion during the course of getting the amendment typed.
Okay. All right. I'm going to ask the Deputy Mayor and the seconder, Councillor Bain, if that further amendment is acceptable. It is acceptable to Deputy Mayor as the mover, and it's acceptable to Councillor Bain. Thank you, Councillor Street. That becomes part of the substantive motion as well. Any further? Nothing further? Okay. Councillor Antoli.
Mayor, once you speak to a substantive before an amendment, can you speak to the amendment after it's been added on?
No, because it's incorporated in the substantive motion.
And how do I record my opposition to the amendment without voting down the entire proposal?
I think you've just said it.
It's unbelievable. Administrative overreach, in my view. It's a private business.
Thank you. Any further discussions? No, I'm going to put the recommendation then. It's moved by the Deputy Mayor and seconded by Councillor Bain. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Yes.
A show of hands is required. All those in favour? Is Councillors Antoli, Dean, Bain, Midgley, Richardson, Street.
No, not Midgley.
Oh, sorry. Beg your pardon. Sorry, I was seeing things. Bain, Richardson, Street, Glade Wright and Reet, and those against is Councillors Fox, Cordova and Midgley. The motion is carried. That brings us to the end of the Planning Authority session, which adjourns at 6:57pm, and open session of Council recommences at 6:57pm. Takes us to page 25, petition still being actioned. A report on the petition curbside collection Leslie Vale will be provided to a future council meeting. Same page, petitions received in the last period. At the time the agenda was compiled, no petitions have been received. And we are now at item 15.1, review of the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy, or STRLUS, as we like to call it, with a recommendation on page 29. Do I have a mover and a seconder, please? I've got a mover in Councillor Midgley and a seconder in the Deputy Mayor. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. This is a really important document for the future of our municipality in regards to our strategic planner, and I'd really like to thank our lead strategic planner for the enormous work that no doubt has taken many years and many conversations across departments in council and liaising with other local government planners as well. So thank you very much for that. So in regards to the importance of this document, it has to also balance our urban and our rural needs. Our metropolitan needs seem clearly defined in the document, but sometimes our rural needs and values in Kingborough are quite diverse. So I've got a couple of points. I'm wondering, in regards to the process for the development of this, I've sort of shared a bit about perhaps some meetings that I've had a conversation with our lead strategic planner about some meetings that they've attended and the conversations they've had across council staff, because it is quite diverse and covers a number of areas. Yeah, what has been, and for the community to understand, what has been the process in regards to developing this lodgement for council?
Mr. Stander.
That's a good question. I'm most probably going to take it back a step a little bit, because I think we need to recognise that this is a regional strategy, so it's not just council. So I guess the deciding point is that in 2025 there was an agreement between all the southern councils that an update of the regional strategy should be conducted. And as part of that process, there was a steering committee established and then also a working group. Now, the working group is basically were strategic planners or senior planners or sometimes managers that provided input on the regional land use strategy. It also involved the state planning office and then infrastructure providers and state agencies. So it's actually quite broad. It's the group of people that provide input. And then at a local scale, it was myself providing input on the document, but obviously I spoke to some of my colleagues in different sections. So it is quite a broad document. If you look at the key topics in there, it's talks about environmental planning, but it talks about growth, it talks about economic development and infrastructure. So it's a wide range of people that provided input on this document. And I guess if you look at the background document itself, you will note that there was a regional coordinator that basically collated all this information, and then at the end of last year the State Planning Office took over the project to make sure that this document really aligned with the Tasmanian planning policies. So simple answers, it's a lot of people that provided input on it, and thank you for the compliment, but it's not just me. I think it's a lot of people that provides input and documents like that. And I think the more important part of this, which we'll most probably talk about later tonight, is the implementation part of it, which is more important, in my opinion, than the actual document.
Thank you. Just a few more points and some things that I thought was important to highlight, that the document really reinforces the values of the environment and the landscape values that we know makes Southern Tasmania so spectacular. It also has some consideration around the diverse population in our urban and rural environments. There's also notes about the town boundaries in Margate and Snug and the fact that they now have increased, knowing that these population areas have increased. It also has a focus on increasing density in the urban settings, but also recognises the need for growth in our rural areas. And it also highlights the need for appropriate infrastructure and job creation. One of the questions or thoughts that I had as well, that it is quite interesting that this has come to us prior to the planning scheme being finalised. And so I'm wondering how the Commission will look at this with the LPS.
Mr. Stander.
That's a very good question. I think there's a bit of uncertainty around that. I did seek some clarification from the Tasmanian Planning Commission. I think if you read the introduction to the document, it talks about the implementation of the LPSs. In reality, we're the only council that's still operating under the interim planning scheme. My opinion is that we've lodged our LPS in 2019 based on the current regional land use strategy, and if you really look at the narrative of this document, it's more about future amendments to LPSs and planning scheme amendments, and not necessarily written in a way to focus on Kimbra draft LPS. I suspect that the Commission will look at this document, potentially both documents, and see how it line. That would, in my view, be the practical approach, but unfortunately I can't really talk on behalf of the Commission.
Thank you. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. Wondering about, in regards to a future guidance for rural areas and, I guess, the input in regards to the rural settlements, will, in the future, for the implementation of this document, what will the conversations be in regards to this and guidance be in regards to our rural areas as part of this development?
Mr. Stander.
And you've most probably picked up in my report that I've highlighted that we still got a lot of strategic work to do, and that's been highlighted through the LPS hearings as well. The document provides some high level guidance, most probably a little bit too high level for my liking, and therefore you will note in the commentary we do seek a little bit more guidance of how that might materialise. In my view, and this is something that we need to talk about, the strategic work that we need to do and how we go about it, I think the starting point would be to discuss it with our community, to go out to our communities and to get feedback really about what their vision is for Kimbra over the next 50 years, and then you work from that to feed in and use this document and the state planning policies really to do, you know, get that strategic work done. So a lot of the strategic work will be that high level discussion, but it will also come down to structure planning, which is most probably a little bit more focused for specific areas, and where you can actually target specific communities of what they want to see in that area. So this document, and you'll pick it up throughout the language, there's a strong focus on better strategic planning upfront and discussion with communities.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. So following this submission, and as we know as well, everybody's invited to put in a submission, I think, until the
22nd of February.
22nd, which is quite soon. What happens? Yeah, what does the future look like in regards to any more conversations with community, consultation, or this is kind of, they'll pull together the final document?
My understanding is, yes, they will put the final document together. I'm not quite sure, but similar to the Tasmanian planning policies, I suspect there will be public hearings to go through the representations to formulate a final document, which ultimately then will be endorsed by the Minister for Planning. This document will get reviewed every 5 years, so there's opportunity every 5 years to look at the document and update it as we, I guess, as we proceed. My feeling is that a lot of the reviews that will be undertaken will be informed by local strategic work. So this document heavily relies on local councils to do some of that work, and obviously that will feed into any future reviews. So I think that's the important message that I get. And then in terms of the implementation of this document, is mainly through the LPSs, so through zoning application, but it also informs structure planning. So, which, once again, those processes also include public consultation. So there's plenty of opportunity for people to get involved with planning and to have a discussion of, you know, talking about the things that's important for them in their communities.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. And just one more question is in regards to how, you know, with the discussion of resource sharing from other councils, and how do you feel like the document provides working together with our other local councils? Is that kind of missing? Does that need to be strengthened? Do you feel like we've highlighted that enough in our report in regards to how we're working together for our future planning?
Mr. Stander.
I really like that question, so thank you for that.
Thought you did.
Yes, resourcing is always a problem, and I'm of the view definitely there needs to be more collaboration, and it is one of the recommendations that we're putting forward, particularly with things like economic development. I don't necessarily think it's something that you have to look at isolation in every council. You could work with your neighbours. So I do see definitely there's opportunity for various of these, I guess, outcomes that we strive for, to work with our neighbouring councils. I kind of already do that through some of the work that I do, but I think it can be formalised a little bit better. In terms of local resourcing and stuff, that's most probably more a question for my director.
Would you like to answer that? No, the CEO would.
I can just add, how we work collaboratively across councils is something that is obviously really important. We've got sort of informal working relationships with a number of our neighbouring councils. I'll note that in addition we've got the Greater Hobart alignment, where we work with other councils within that Greater Hobart area. And then there's other projects that have reached into Brighton and Sorell as well to work on a more strategic and regional basis in terms of how we operate. Additionally, there's the Southern Tasmania Council Network, which is something that is brand new and is just evolving at the moment, and we're looking at what the collective work program is around those Southern Tasmania councils to think about how we work together, share ideas and leverage our collective resource to be able to achieve more together.
Thank Councillor Midgley.
That's all. Thank you very much for the informative information. It's just great to have a passionate strategic planner at the helm of all this for our vision for the, now and the future.
Thank you. Deputy Mayor, and then Councillor Cordova, and then Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. I just want to... Councillor Midgley asked all my questions, but I just want to drill down a little bit further. This submission that you've prepared, has this had any input from the community, or this is just based on your professional knowledge?
It is a technical input, so this is the opportunity for council really to, through the commentary that council has made tonight, will feed into the submission, which is essentially through delegation of the general manager. So any commentary that we receive tonight, additional commentary, we could include, but this is more a technical comment. The document itself, the Southern Tasmania Regional Strategy, did undergo through some preliminary consultation. I think it was end of last year, where the state government did invite community groups to provide input, and I know that a lot of people did actually provide input through formal submissions, but also attending workshops and so forth. So I guess that part of the document had some community consultation. This report that's in front of you tonight is more a technical response, I guess, from a strategic point of view, but it gives councillors the opportunity, to raise concerns or to make suggestions that we potentially could incorporate into a formal submission to the State Planning Office.
Deputy Mayor.
There's not time, though, to do some community consultation.
Unfortunately not, and I think that's one of the comments that I made at a previous council meeting is really for community members, this is your opportunity to provide commentary. I think some people might have misinterpreted that I indicated that everybody needs to do their own submission. I think we've incorporated some of the messages that we already received through discussions in this chamber as well, but I think this is really a submission from council, and there's still opportunity for people in the community to make their own representations. I don't think there's ability for us to further engage given the time frame, but I know my director's most probably got something to add to that.
Ms. Shakuti. Oh, thank you. Wanted to clarify that this is also the public consultation for the Strelas process, so the whole, community of these different municipalities can put their own submissions individually and as groups. So, in my view, it's probably not necessary for council to do additional consultation when, this is the consultation process that has been designed by the state government.
I'm just interested in how our submission is formed and then the interplay with external submissions from the community. I guess they get put into the melting pot somewhere else, not with us. But you mentioned further strategic work, and I just want to understand when does that happen and what's that for?
Good question. I think our priority at the moment is the LPS. That's really on our work program. So after the LPS, I think we'll need to sit down and finalise the projects, because there's a lot of projects that we actually need to do, and a lot of it's to do with where do we grow? What towns do we have to go back and look at? Is there towns that we need additional infrastructure, or do we have areas where we can actually optimise infrastructure? So there's a lot of work that we need to do, and a lot of that is community consultation. So I think this document really sets the scene for that, and in my view, it articulates it quite well in terms of the work that local councils need to do. So we can't just rely on state government to provide the direction. We as a community also need to, provide a view and provide a setting of how we are a community grow over the next 20, 25 years.
Deputy Mayor, if I don't call your name, then your microphone doesn't turn on, so...
Sorry. So what happens then if your professional view is at odds with the community's view?
Mr. Stander.
very good question. I hope it's not, but if it is, I think this is ultimately it is the State Planning Office that that will go through all the submissions, and I suspect there will be various views even between councils. I can tell you I've seen some of the draft submissions and some of them are very different, and then there's also a disparity between metropolitan councils and more some of the rural and coastal councils. So I suspect there will be mixed commentary that the State Planning Office will review, and my understanding is it ultimately the document will also be undergo some scrutiny through the Tasmanian Planning Commission that will provide some recommendations to the Minister. So that is my view, I guess, in terms of how this could work. The challenge is that there's always going to be different opinions, whether that's between, you know, officer or community, or even between officers or different councils. So unfortunately, I don't necessarily think we can resolve all of that. The commentary in this document is more about strategic planning, I guess a technical input on that. I appreciate that the community might have additional commentary that they want to provide, and I certainly would encourage them to make a submission to that effect.
Deputy Mayor.
Thank you for answering so well. I understand that you are the best strategic planner in Tasmania, and I don't think that's lost on any of us here. So thank you very much, and we're very lucky to have you.
Next, I had Councillor Cordova and then Councillor Antoli after that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor, and thanks so much for the work that's gone into this. I wanted to focus my contribution and questions on the social determinants of health and how those play into our submission to the Strelis. As we all probably are aware, where you live in Australia has a major impact on your life expectancy, income, education, housing, quality, access to services, transport, healthy food, green spaces and healthcare. These are all major factors, and a whole bunch of work has been done by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare related to socioeconomic inequality, and they basically look at the CIFA indexes, and you can look at heart health or any number of factors. My question really is, what is Kingborough Council going to say when it comes to the Strelis about talking about the impact of socioeconomic inequality and where that meets healthy by design in urban planning? Are we going to be really strong when we make our submission about talking about the need to incorporate socioeconomic inequality considerations into planning and development in southern Tasmania?
Mr. Stander.
Thank you for that question. It's certainly been a topic that's been brought up numerous times at the workshops. I guess the challenge that we often have with strategic documents, it's so high level that often those type of messages that we want to carry through gets missed. I guess our response, there's some draft wording that we've got in attachment one, most probably not going through to the detail that you would like to see it, and it's really up to councillors to provide us with feedback tonight that we can incorporate it. But you'll note, and I'm just trying to find the specific point there, but I did put in the document that the document lacks a bit of clarity around how that should happen on the ground level. My commentary is more about urban design. We want to see higher densities in some of our neighbourhoods, and we need to understand how those neighbourhoods can be retrofitted. So a little bit more guidance, I think, would be good in this document. I suspect that the document most probably didn't provide that level of detail, because often it's more something that you need to look at a local level. So I've asked similar questions before, and the advice that I've received was it's something that you need to do at a local level. But I definitely agree with you. There's opportunity for this document to mention that, but it's mostly have to sit within the implementation plan. And if you look at the document at the moment, there's no implementation plan, and that really is the challenge to provide input on a document. So a lot of the commentary that is in attachment one is say we need a little bit more guidance, we need more I guess, input in terms of how you apply it at a local level. So I think we all realised it's something that we want to take on board, but this document, there's an opportunity for that to address that a little bit more explicitly.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, and that's really encouraging. I think there are, particularly when we look at the Channel Highway Corridor study or active transport links that go beyond the boundaries of Kingborough and into Huon Valley or into Hobart City Council Municipality, I think it's critically important. It's not just with active transport though, of course, it's food deserts as well. The access to healthy and affordable food, mixed use within higher density. If you have a lot of different housing types and typology, then that allows for people from socioeconomically disadvantaged backgrounds to actually be in areas where they do have better access to health, better access to educational services and the like. So I think it's a really critical element that clearly is broader than just the boundaries of Kingborough. And in fact, the number of disability adjusted life years ignores those specific municipal boundaries, and it really focuses on the regions and the infrastructure that's in those regions. So I'd like to reflect on what I think was the one of the major improvements to Lupa in 2015 was when they put into the objectives at part two, health and wellbeing, to promote the health and wellbeing of all Tasmanians and visitors to Tasmania by ensuring a pleasant, efficient and safe environment for working, living and recreation. By adding that into Lupa, that allowed us to then say every time we talk about development, well, what is it doing for the health and wellbeing of Tasmanians? So I feel like Strelis should have some version of that within the objectives that says every time we talk about cohesive integrated development across municipal boundaries, but anywhere in southern Tasmania, it should have regard to what is the impact on economic inequality and what is the impact on the health and wellbeing of the people who are living, whether they're in Huon Valley or whether they're on Bruny Island or whether they're here or in Taroon on the border of Hobart City Council and here. This is an issue that obviously stretches beyond our boundaries, so I think it needs to be incorporated at a high level within Strelis. So that would be my main request, is to really hit home that point about we are aware that urban development has impact, for better or for worse, on health and wellbeing, on life expectancy, on disability-adjusted life years, and on economic inequality. And this document has to speak to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Stander would like to respond.
It's most probably I most probably didn't articulate. The document talks about it, but most probably not to the level that we want. So in the front end of the document, under growth management, it talks specifically about those outcomes. Land use planning incorporates measures to promote community health and well-being. I guess what I'm saying is we mostly can do a little bit more in the document to articulate how that is achieved through regional and local planning. So my
question, Councillor Cordova.
So my question is, when we do submit about how, and I agree with, we want more implementation specifics, can I please ask, is it a good idea to add in, when we talk about the implementation plan, to add in that we Kingborough would like to see implementation ideas that speak to those concepts of socioeconomic inequality?
Mr. Stander.
I think it's possible. I'm looking at my general manager because it is the report is giving essentially the general manager or CEO the delegation to provide the commentary. So I'm happy to add that to the draft document, but obviously it is open for discussion tonight. But I think it's a good idea. Thank you.
Would you like to speak?
I have to admit, I didn't catch the portion of conversation that led up to that.
Surprise, the element of surprise.
I can help
Mr.
you.
Mr. Stander, would you like to help your CEO?
There was a suggestion that we just add another, initiative to our submission that specifically talks about community health and well-being. I did have some commentary to that effect in attachment. One is mostly not going down to that level, but happy to provide that. It is in the document already stated, but I guess we just want to see more detail in the implementation plan of the document, which is still up for discussion.
The CEO.
Thank you. Now that I understand where we're at,
I think that is something that if council is comfortable with, we can flesh out under the delegation that you're providing to me to authorise the final submission to expand a little bit more on those sort of wellbeing related outcomes that can be achieved through this plan, and to make sure that's incorporated in our feedback.
Okay. Councillor Cordova, did you have anything further? Then we've got Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a question through you, Mayor, if I may, to Mr. Stander about whether he was aware of Clarence City Council's pretty strong criticism of Stralis. So you're nodding and affirming. Okay. There was a number of issues where they felt that there was too much of a focus of containment and a disconnect between the needs of the rural community versus the municipal urban boundary, and they were really quite critical of a blunt instrument of releasing land as much as possible to deal with housing issues. Given that they were very strong, they're quoted in the papers as saying that the whole Stralis was a wasted opportunity. So they've really expressed some strong language. There's been a bit of back criticism to them from the government about the strength of the language, and a councillor, David Hume, is being quoted as saying that he would like it to be a lot stronger. What's our view on the pushback they've given? Given that they are quite similar to us in their needs, I would say we're probably more blessed by rural settlements than they are. But this pushback on containment to deal with the need for the state to provide services at an adequate level to defined localised communities versus what the request of our communities, they want to live in their villages, their locations, and they'd like the services to be built around them rather than all being squished up into Kingston. Can I get a bit of a worldview on that? Because that would help frame my next three questions.
Mr. Stander.
Thank you for that question. Look, yes, I'm aware of Clarence's opinion, and I dare say there's a couple of other councils, particularly regional councils, that's got a very similar approach, which is one of the challenges when you have a regional document with different viewpoints on that. I guess what I've recommended in this particular report is must well be a little bit more of a balanced approach. It is recognising that, yes, we want to optimise our services and infrastructure, so there's a role for urban growth boundary in metropolitan areas. The draft document at the moment actually helps us in a way, most probably better than Clarence. It still talk about growth in areas outside the metropolitan areas. In our case, Margaret and Snug, we've advocated for changes to that town boundary that's occurred. So in a way, that ticks one box for us. Then the document also talk about if you want to, I guess, encourage growth or facilitate growth, the focus a little bit more on sustainable development, and that's where it talks about structure planning. And I think that gives us opportunities actually to go through our towns and say, well, actually, what do we see for let's say Kettering, or what do we see for Woodbridge, and do more localised planning. So I think I must really have a more positive take on their approach of Stralis. So I'm not as critical of the document, but I also understand where some of those councils are coming from. It's not new to me. A lot of those councils have indicated that there's a strong focus on growth in metropolitan areas. I guess what our submission is saying, we have both. We've got a metropolitan area, and then we've got rural areas. It creates challenges for us, but we also recognise that people have different lifestyles, different ideas how they want to live. So we basically want to accommodate both. Our representation is more about, well, give us a little bit more guidance on that. How do we go about it? So I feel comfortable doing that. I don't necessarily feel putting in a submission to oppose a document, because there's parts that we don't necessarily agree 100% with is the way to go. It's more about providing input, positive input, that the state government and the minister ultimately can consider.
Councillor Ntali.
Thank you, sir. My take from what you've just shared is that the draft document probably works a little bit more in our favour than it may have for Clarence. Does our response, rather than saying give us some guidance on how we can better satisfy Margate, Kettering and Snug, does our response say here are the ways that we believe the strata should be changed to better satisfy the growth needs of those villages and those areas?
Mr. Stander.
It's most probably not going into that level of detail, because that is something that still needs to be developed through an implementation plan. So there's plenty of opportunity for us actually as part of that process to go to that level of detail. Our response is a little bit more general, to say, you know, for instance, one of the clauses in our response, I'm suggesting that we talk about a stronger focus on our rural settlements and looking at the needs for those communities, economic development and so forth. So it's a little bit more broad, but, you know, certainly I agree with what you're saying. We most probably can be stronger in our message, but I most probably would suggest that that is something that needs to be done through the implementation plan.
Councillor Ntali.
Thank you. And my final question is around the balance between environmental protection and development and that tension. My read of the original document is that it seemed to favour avoiding developments where there was that tension rather than managing it or rather than dealing with the risk. What's your view on the philosophy there and our response to that?
Mr. Stander.
Our approach and the suggestions that I've made in attachment, one is talking about a balanced approach. I'll keep it simple. I think we need to recognise we have an interesting setting in Kimbra where we're always going to have a bit of friction in relation to that. What we're seeking through our submission is a bit of balance and, once again, guidance. How do you actually manage that? It's good to have some policy statements of how it should occur, but how do you actually manage those, would I dare say, conflicting priorities? Once again, I'll go back to some of the commentary that I made earlier about community engagement. I think there's still a lot of work for us to do in Kimbra to go out to our communities to get a better understanding of what communities, want in their particular areas, but also more working on a vision really for Kimbra as a whole.
Councillor Ntali.
Thanks, Mayor. Look, my read of especially attachment one was there probably wasn't anything in there I could disagree with. I thought it was balanced, and I thought it had a nice counter to what, to me, the draft was a bit more in favour of environmental protection and less in development. It was like avoid, just don't stay away from those areas. And I liked your approach that you also took into consideration bushfire protection. You took of all the LGAs in Tasmania, of the LGAs in the Greater Hobart area, I would say we are at the top of in danger of that, and history would sadly prove that to be correct. So I appreciated you bringing that up as well. I understand that consultation is open until February the 22nd, we've heard before, and I understand that some of the interested associations, action groups have been asked to respond effectively to the government directly, and I think you might have had conversations with them. Is that the best way for them to engage, or do they do it through council? How does it work for them?
Thank you. My suggestion would be to make a submission through the there's a web page, Shaping Tasmania. I would suggest that people actually utilise that platform, make a submission. Council will do its own submission. I think there's going to be various ideas, so it would be better for individuals or community groups to make a submission through that portal.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. That's all the questions I had, and I'm happy to support the document. This is sort of dry stuff, but people don't understand the strategy affects the implementation. So if you get it wrong here, then we're constrained for the next 10 years. I am very concerned that the government said, and in fact, this is a question I'd like some feedback on. The government has said that they're going to take 10 years to implement this, but there's no actual plan as to when. Maybe you can clarify for me, but my read of the situation is going to take 10 years before they implement it, but they're not going to tell us when that starts. Have I got that right?
Mr. Stander.
I can't really talk on behalf of the state government, but generally with these implementation plans, it does take some time. And I'll reflect on the Greater Hobart plan. You know, we're still busy with the implementation of some of those actions. So it can take a while to develop the implementation plan, but also to action it. And you mostly will pick up in my, I guess, recommendations. Given that, shouldn't we be thinking beyond 25 years? If it's going to take that long to get an implementation plan, we should be really thinking about 50 plus years. So unfortunately, I can't answer your question, but happy to follow that up.
Thank you. Councillor Antoli, anything further?
No, that's all from me. No. Thank you.
Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you for the report. I think it's fantastic. It's full of great suggestions and just calling out so many examples of where we like where things are going, but we need more detail, so please give it to us. Just a couple of questions. The 1.9, where it talks about the draft, removes the application of the urban growth boundary to Margate and Snug, and then instead identifies these settlements as towns with defined settlement boundaries. The implications of that, is do we lose anything with that happening, or is it all gaining?
Sorry, Mr. Stan.
No, we're definitely gaining, and it's, I guess there's two parts to it. So in the current regional land use strategy, Margate and Snug got urban growth boundary, which has been quite challenging to deal with some of the pressures that we've got there. So what's happening, the urban growth boundary essentially now wraps around Kingston, Blackmans Bay, Huntingfield, and Margate and Snug is dealt with slightly differently, because it's got its own needs, first of all, and its own infrastructure challenges that's different from Kingston. So there's opportunity to do structure planning, to look at the future of both those towns and the role that they play in the broader catchment. And I guess what we've gained through this process is something that we've always had in our local land use strategy, is we've envisaged potential growth in Margate and Snug, and that's been captured through the mapping that's in this document. So it is definitely a win for Kimbra.
Councillor Bain.
Thank you. And just a second question. Under 1.11.5, you talk about it is recommended that a central region-wide monitoring dashboard be established to track housing demand and supply, land availability, development activity, and infrastructure capacity. Sounds like a fantastic idea, which would benefit like all Southern Councils and the government and all the infrastructure providers. Can you speak to that a bit more?
Mr. Stander.
I think I'm not the only one that wants that. It's been raised so many times throughout the years that we need a central dashboard for that. And you're quite right. It's not just for local councils. It's for service providers as well and developers to have an understanding of where's the need, where do we need to grow, and so forth. So I've seen it happen in other states and overseas. It will come down to who takes ownership of that and the cost implications. So I suspect that many other councils will have similar recommendations in their submission.
Any further contributions? I just wanted to, I won't, I think it's had a certainly a good discussion around the table. I just wanted to thank Mr. Stander for the work that he's done on this, and particularly for the points that he's made on his on the attachment, particularly those ones at 8.5.1 to 8.5.5, where he's made suggestions, particularly around
the implementation improvements. And I think it's all very well, as we know, to have strategic plans, but the devil is in the detail of how these are implemented. And clearly, through his own expertise, Mr. Standers identified some practical suggestions on how it could be improved, the implementation, to make it clearer for the all the councils in the implementation. So I appreciate that, and that we will be putting in this response to the well overdue review of Strelas, because I think it was due in 2015 and then talked about in 2019, and it has dragged on, and they do say it's going to be reviewed every 5 years, and I don't even see how that's even possible given how long this has taken. It's been a bit of a shambles, and I know that the Local Government Association has been pursuing this for some time to try and encourage the government to get moving on it, and then it took until 2024 for that to start happening. So well and truly overdue, particularly for Kingborough and other municipalities in the south who have experienced significant growth, and for those of us who know that we're going to have growth in the future. And I do particularly like the concept that we should be looking at a 50-year growth cycle rather than 25 years. I think that is very important given the lag time in formulation of the strategy and then a long implementation period of a decade. So thank you very much. And Councillor Midgley, would you like to sum up? Okay, I'm going to put the recommendation, moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by the Deputy Mayor. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. I'm going to suggest now, I asked the Deputy Mayor to remind me if when we, so that I didn't just try and keep going through. I think given the, we've got quite a few more significant items on the agenda this evening, so it might be time to take a comfort break if we can have 10 minutes and be back here at 7:50. Apologies to those who are with us in person or to anyone watching along on YouTube. We just need to have a quick break and we will be back a little fresher. Thank you. All right, welcome back. We'll keep going. So the meeting, open session of the meeting is resumed at 7:50 p.m. We are now on page 41, item 15.2, AGM notice of motion, development application requests for information, with a recommendation on page 43. And I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. A mover in Councillor Cordova and a seconder, Councillor Bain. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. So this is 15.2. It is the purpose of the report is to respond to the AGM notice of motion from the 2nd of December 2025 relating to requests for information to be made during the assessment of development applications. And the recommendation there is that the response to the motion is noted and that Council continues progressing improvement initiatives relating to development application processes, including initiatives related to RFIs. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm just concerned we don't have Mrs. Morton in the room and therefore we've got nobody noting who is not at in the room. So we're missing Councillor Antoli and we were missing Councillor Midgley from 7:50 to 7:51. Sorry, just to catch you up, Councillor Midgley was out of the room from 7:50 to 7:51. Councillor Antoli left the room at 7:50 and hasn't returned. Okay, thank you, Councillor Cordova. Further discussion? Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a question around 4.9 and the last dot point where it says publishing periodic high-level public data and updates that supports transparency and explain drivers of assessment timeframes. Can we have staff expand on that a little bit?
Ms. Chakuti.
Thank you. So we have obviously a continuous improvement program at Council. We have a focus on all of our processes, including our planning processes, and looking at, I suppose, an end-to-end review of that from pre-lodgement right through to I'm about to dig a hole. And so we're doing some, I suppose, structured focus on that. And as part of that work, at the end of that, what we would like to have identified is meaningful KPIs, performance indicators, that tell us, you know, our, I suppose I don't want to use the word performance, but how we are tracking in terms of assessment timeframes, etc. But then also being able to delineate what the different causes of that are and if any are associated with council's processes as well. So we're not at a stage where we know what they are. There's a bit of work to understand that and ensure that they're carefully selected. But the intent is, you know, in the future, and hopefully not too far away, we'll be able to produce regular reports, not sure on the frequency, around the different indicators that that will help people understand the process and the different drivers of the process.
Councillor Bain.
Thank you. I'm happy to support the recommendation. I think the report clearly shows how much work would be involved by our staff to come up with these data sets, so I think that's probably unrealistic and not a good use of staff's time. But I do like under 4.9 that we are aware of issues that need to be fixed, we're working on them, and we're planning on producing some reports in the future which will address some of these issues. So happy to support the recommendation.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Any further discussion? Not, I will put the recommendation. Councillor Cordova, you didn't want to sum up. I'll put the recommendation, moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Bain. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 44, AGM Notice of Motion, Trees on Private Property Bylaw, with a recommendation on page 46. Looking for a mover and a seconder. Moved Councillor Cordova, seconded Councillor Midgley. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. We're looking here now at the 6th of December 2025 Annual General Meeting. A motion was carried that the Council abandon any plans to introduce the Trees on Private Land bylaw and return the certificate to create this new bylaw back to the State. The recommendation from Council officers is that Council defer any work on the proposed Trees on Private Property bylaw, bylaw 1 of 2022, until the Tasmanian Planning Scheme is adopted. And on adoption of the Tasmanian Planning Scheme, a council workshop be held to discuss the future of the Trees on Private Property bylaw, bylaw 1 of 2022. Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? No? No? Okay. I will put the recommendation moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Page 47, item 15.4, reconsideration of AGM motion 2023 environmental reports. The recommendation on page 49, looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved, Councillor Cordova. Seconded, Councillor Fox. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. This is 15.4, reconsideration of AGM motion 2023 environmental reports. The purpose here is to reconsider a motion passed at the Council's AGM on the 2nd of December 2023. The motion was first considered at the subsequent Council meeting on 18th of December 2023, where the decision was deferred pending a workshop discussion. Due to an inadvertent oversight, a report was not brought back to Council following the workshop and is now being presented. The recommendation here is that Council determines that the change proposed in the motion is not required at this time and reaffirms its existing processes, noting that these already include internal expert review, requests for further information where clarification or additional detail is needed, seeking advice from external agencies, and the option to commission an external review. And Council notes that the escalation process described in the report will be documented in an internal process and communicated to staff. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. So this is an unusual one because it's not normal for us to delay inadvertently or otherwise. I have two questions around what happened. What was the inadvertent oversight? Because I'm not entirely satisfied with that response, especially given that I am a representative of a community that's based in the area that where the lady who brought this first brought it up in her community. So what happened? And also, why is my microphone pinging? Can you all hear that? Is it just me having a stroke?
Can hear it, but no, not sure why. Maybe just move it a tiny bit back. Sometimes I think they can get affected a little bit by mobile phones in proximity. Who knows? Okay, Ms. Shakuti.
Thank you. The inadvertent omission was simply so we had the workshop and we did not then follow up and produce another report to come back. It was simply an oversight and something that wasn't intended to have not occurred.
Councillor Ntoli.
Thank you. So we were sort of, it's not like we didn't action it at all, we just didn't actually lodge a formal report. Have we actually sent any correspondence to Ms Kirkpatrick and apologised to her for that?
Ms Shakuti.
We've been having some ongoing correspondence with Mrs Kirkpatrick, not recently, but in regard to another matter, and we did provide an update about this and apologised, yes. And I believe also there was an apology in the questions on notice in our response.
And I think verbally when this was raised a few weeks ago as well. My recollection is. Councillor Ntoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm happy to support the report for now. I do know that our planning function is under review this year, but I do know that this is a sore point with a lot of people who feel that council weaponises the planning process so that when, in the view of the community, council gets a report that they're not entirely satisfied with or the individual isn't satisfied with, they request another one and it becomes this painful, expensive burden. It's a bit related to the agenda item 15.2, where RFIs, people in the community feel RFIs become weaponised, that 1 or 2 days before the statutory time limit ends, an RFI is flicked out to extend the process because either the staff are overwhelmed or whatever, and that's the perception that people have. I think these sorts of things are solved with a change in culture. And how can we help you realise your dreams culture? And I think that's definitely something that our CEO wants to see happen more thoroughly. But I do think that if these sorts of complaints continue beyond, I would say, October or November, if I'm blessed to be returned, this is something that I'm going to be bringing up as even a notice of motion that we have to look into. Because we just can't have this perception happening so regularly. And I do know it's an instrument in the planning system nationally with councils where that is a constant criticism. So for now, I'm tentatively happy to support it because I believe our CEO has a customer service heart and I'm confident that he'll be able to turn the ship around. But if we don't see some changes and we continue to hear complaints from the community on this issue, then I think it's actually a reform that is worth considering. But that's my contribution for now. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Any further contributions? Deputy Mayor and then Councillor Richardson.
Yeah, just, I guess this is related back a bit to the RFI one as well, but is there, have we reviewed as well what it is that we're asking for in the first place to ensure that that is correctly understood, so we're not receiving things back that aren't meeting what we're looking for? Did that make any sense?
Not to me, but
have we reviewed the way we're asking for information? The way we're asking for information,
Ms. Shakuti.
Not formally to this point, but it is an initiative that we're currently working on, and we'll be continuing to do that, ensuring that, first of all, the way that we ask for information is easy to understand, and is only asking for information that is necessary.
Yeah, I just think it's the deputy mayor.
It's just good, you know, if we can see something that's reoccurring, that we take ownership of our part in that. But it sounds like you're looking into that.
Hang on. No, next I had. Have you finished, deputy mayor?
Yes.
Yep. Next I had Councillor Richardson, and then Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. I just wanted to dig in a little bit to the actual motion itself. It reads to me as the intent of the motion is to ensure that when a report is requested by an expert, and that is then paid for and provided by the applicant, that unless there is significant technical issues with that report, that the findings of that report be honoured by council. And then if we wish to argue with that report, it is then incumbent upon us to provide substantial evidence that the report is incorrect.
Ms. Shakuti.
I haven't finished yet.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I thought that was the end of the question. Apologies.
That's okay. I'm not entirely convinced as yet that the existing process with the escalations and the internal peer review sufficiently addresses the concerns in the motion. End.
Thank you for that prompt. Ms. Shakuti.
Thank you. The recommendation was formed out of the outcomes of the workshop that we had in October 2024, I believe. So that was discussed at length with councillors in that workshop. I agree. So we, planning staff, will only raise issues if there's inaccuracy, inconsistent plans, you know, incorrect information or you know, facts, I suppose, in the report pertaining to the property, you know, potentially the wrong address or something like that. And that's actually really important that they're correct, because, you know, then they do, you know, could need to be relied upon. Well, they need to be relied upon for the actual construction and permitting, and they could be relied upon in an appeal as well. In terms of if council staff disagree with, I suppose, a finding of the report, it is escalated, and we do have instances that, you know, I can, you know, in my time, I've been at council where we have actually already sought an independent peer review if we are disagreeing or with the findings of the report. This recommendation is to, I suppose, formalise that process and ensure that planning staff are aware of the process and know of the triggers to when they do need to escalate. And then the decision can come to the appropriate member of executive, which I imagine most parts will be myself, and, you know, I may need to escalate to the CEO in some instances if it's particularly complex. and that we would make an informed decision about how we approach that report and whether we need a peer review.
Councillor Richards.
Thank you. As part of that process, is there going to be or likely to be any guidance given to staff on when it is appropriate to disagree with an expert opinion?
Ms. Shakuti.
Thank you. Yes, I suppose what will be yet to write the procedure, so I'm sort of preempting what it might look like. There will be guidance around what is, you know, I suppose what we would call standard or needed amendments to a report, like what I previously described. And yes, we would provide some guidance around why or when we might, or professional staff might have a difference of opinion, noting that the difference of opinion is a professional difference of opinion and often coming from a, you know, technical expertise within our staff as well. So, but yes, there would be some guidelines and I suppose prompts for when to seek assistance from executive.
Councillor Richardson.
That's all, thanks.
Any further discussion? Councillor Cordova.
A question through you, Mayor. The question is about the modelling that may or may not have been done relating to the cost. So thinking now about how 4.1 says that these are reports that are geotechnical, natural values, contaminated land, arboricultural, bushfire reports, etc., and that the cost, this is in 5.1, is between $1,000 and $8,000 for a single peer review. Have we done any modelling on the, firstly, the cost to council, but also more broadly, I guess the what I'm trying to say is the equity implications of, obviously, the people who are getting reports done are people who are developers with land. Are there any kind of equity implications that we need to consider when it comes to paying for their reports? When there's a whole bunch of other people in Kingborough who don't have, who don't get $1,000 to $8,000 spent on them by council
for
their stuff.
Thank you. That's a difficult question to answer. And we are approaching it from an assessment and ensuring that our assessment is in line with the scheme and the requirements. And unfortunately, I suppose equity considerations don't come into that. I would say that it's not often that we would this situation arises where we would seek independent peer review. And the reason for that is often we have other agencies, so for example DSG, TasWater, TasNetworks, NRE, TFS, who often hold a lot of the expertise around the different components of technical reports. So we also have our own development engineers, etc. So it's not often that this would arise, and no, we unfortunately we can't consider those factors.
Further discussion? Questions? No, otherwise, Councillor Cordova, did you want to sum up? Okay, I'll put the recommendation. Moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 53, item 15.5, land lease, Kingborough Sports Precinct, with the recommendation on page 55. And I'm looking for a mover and a seconder. Moved, Councillor Bain. Seconded, Councillor Street. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. So the purpose of this report is to recommend a lease of land in the Kingborough Sports Precinct to the Tasmanian Devils Football Club for the High Performance Centre. So part of the process is, as part of the Act, Council must publicly advertise its intention to dispose of the land and consider any objections received following this process. That process has been completed and Council received no objections, with the only correspondence received being one of support. So we proceed. A couple of key points to note from a finance perspective. 5.1, so the cost of the construction of the High Performance Centre and reconstruction of any displaced infrastructure is being met by the state government and the AFL. I think that's important to note. And 5.2, other than any relevant statutory obligations associated with use of the land, council will not be responsible for any aspect of the operations of the facility, including maintenance, insurance or depreciation of the asset. So both important key points that we're not putting any of these costs onto the ratepayer. And then just going down to the recommendation around the lease agreements, a couple of key points here to get on the record. It's going to be a peppercorn rent. However, full rates and charges will be payable. And I imagine being an expensive building, that's going to be some substantial rates. The use is for the AFL High Performance Training Centre and Admin Centre. If the lease agreement is terminated by the Tasmanian Devils Football Club, it will be reassigned to the state government. So the building, the lease agreement will go to the state government, not back to council. And the lease applies to the land only. So the Tasmanian Devils will be the owner of all assets constructed on the parcel of land and responsible for the depreciation costs. And just to finalise the recommendation here, one of the key points is the final one, and that talks about the signing of the above lease agreement is subject to confirmation from the state government that all elements of the project are fully funded. Now, this is an important one because this clause is essential to give the community confidence that all aspects of hosting the High Performance Centre, including the community-related infrastructure, will be fully funded by the state government and not fall back on the ratepayers. Everything we've seen and all the projects received, all the reports received so far, indicate the partnership with the state government and the Tasmanian Devils has been positive and the project is progressing well. However, given the current budget constraints, I think it's important the council has a responsibility to our ratepayers to ensure the community is not exposed to any financial risk. So it is appropriate to have this clause in here to ensure that we are essentially waiting for the state government's May budget to receive confirmation that all the remaining projects are funded. And when we receive that confirmation, we'll be able to finalise the lease. So happy to support the recommendation and look forward to construction being underway.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley, and then Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. Councillor Baines raised quite a few points that I was going to ask questions about just to get clarification for the community. It is a really important project, and there are, I think, what Councillor Bain raised in regards to signing of the above lease agreement to be subject to confirmation from the state government that all elements of the project are fully funded. That is reassuring for our community to understand this. When we talk about all of the projects are fully funded, I know this answer, but for the community to understand, the Spring Farm Whitewater Road, is that part of all of these projects, elements?
No, so it's always been identified that that was a separate pool of funding that would be required and would come from the Department of State Growth Roads section. So that was not, because you may recall that we did make it a condition of proceeding with the High Performance Centre that that the Spring Farm Link Road be built within 3 years of completion of the Performance Centre, and it was acknowledged that they would be looking, the state government would look at additional funding for that.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So, and in regards to all of the projects, I have heard that perhaps not all of the other elements are in the state budget. So I guess, and the forecast for that, can we be absolutely reassured that they might, that they're not going to build the High Performance Centre and the Oval, and then all the other projects might get left off the list because we didn't have a budget for it? Like, are we absolutely reassured that the other elements of this project are going to happen?
Did anyone take that? CEO.
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry.
Okay.
Apologies for anyone listening. There's a bit of recoil in the room from the sound. So, as noted within that final section of the recommendation tonight, the intent is, whilst we want to do everything we can to help progress this project, the lease wouldn't come into effect until after the we're satisfied that all funding allocation is required to undertake the community infrastructure works as part of this project have been allocated by the state government. So it's an ace up our sleeve, if you like, to make sure that this project continues smoothly, but council and our ratepayers are not left in a compromised position at the end of this process. As has been noted earlier, this project has been one that's gone really smoothly in terms of the partnership approach that we've taken both with the state government and with the Tasmanian Football Club, and that has been a really positive hallmark of how this has progressed so far, and I have no concerns at this stage that will change. But this is, I guess, an insurance that we take to make sure that we're protecting the interests of our ratepayers through this process.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. And just a question about the...
Well, can't hear you at all.
I'm talking in it.
Try again. Thank you. Just a question about the term up to 99 years. Just wondering, that's quite a large number of years. Wondering how we got to that.
It's just me.
So, in our initial thoughts, the land was to be transferred to the state government, freehold. However, it was the preference from the Devils that they wanted to own the land. Council's position was that we were more comfortable with a long-term lease. Now, obviously, the Devils want security of tenure. It's a significant investment for them, and they want the maximum security of tenure that a lease can provide, being up to 99 years. So that's the reason for this particular recommendation in relation to the term. It's around giving the Devils comfort that they're going to be there for the long term.
Councillor Midgley, nothing further. Who indicated next? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. And thanks to Councillor Bain for his pretty thorough introduction and the point about how the state government needs to complete its support of us, and we hope to hear good things come May, noting that our treasurer is also a local member here, so no pressure. I can't help but endorse the support for this, to be full-throated support for this move. I've been a supporter of the stadium from day one, supporter of our bid from day one. It should have come to us instead of going to Clarence. The state government should have realised that Clarence was in an absolute pickle on this particular thing, and that lovely LGA tore itself apart over this, and we were united from day one. We've received no objections. There's been no protests, so the thing would be half built by now if the state government had actually given it to us in the first place. But nonetheless, here we find ourselves, and I look forward to us being able to complete this in conjunction with the state government. And I look forward to welcoming the people who will move here, the families, the players. It's going to be a game changer, no pun intended, for us all. And I want to congratulate Council for their generosity of spirit in the way that they've bent over backwards to work with the Tassie Devils. I hope that the fans around the state appreciate how welcoming Canberra has been, the leadership team at Kingborough Council has been, and I've complimented our CEO and his team more than once on how they've handled the negotiations. I think it's been one of the high points for the leadership of our CEO since his tenure started with us 2 years ago, in the way he's handled this. It's been difficult, but we've managed to bring it to this current exciting stage, and I look forward to continuing to support the team with all reasonable means into the future.
Thank you, Councillor Antoli. Is that a willingness to speak, Councillor Dean? That was just scratching your head. Look, just briefly, just for my contribution, I'm delighted that we've got this before us today and that we're moving forward with this. I think that the option of the lease is certainly offers the protection to the community that should anything untoward happen with the in the future of the Tasmanian Devils Football Club, that we are protected in that the lease would go to the state government, and so we're not going to be left holding the baby, so to speak. But importantly, with a lease, the land doesn't still belongs to council in the long term, and I think that's something that the community would definitely support us with. So this is another step forward in the High Performance Centre becoming a reality here, and I note we did have somebody in the public gallery earlier from one of the existing tenant clubs who was here to see this come through tonight, and I think because of the length of time we've been here already and discussing other matters, he has left, but I know there's a lot of interest from the existing tenants, the Kingborough Knights and the Kingborough Tigers Football Club, as we move this forward, and in a very exciting day for Kingborough indeed. So I'm happy to support this and also echo my thanks to the staff who have been working diligently on this. Any further contributions? Councillor Bain, did you want to sum up?
Thank you, Mayor. Only to say thank you for the contributions and echo your comments and Councillor Antoli's comments to say there's been a lot of people who have, I guess, played a part in this, including all the tenant clubs, all the staff, and to get an outcome here where there's going to be no losers and all winners, I think is a fantastic result. So, again, thank you.
Thank you. I'll put the recommendation moved by Councillor Bain and seconded by Councillor Street. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 56, Oval Lease, Kingborough Sports Precinct, with a recommendation on page 57. Looking for a mover and a seconder for that. Councillor Bain, did you want to do that?
And do, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor. I'm just trying to share the love, because Councillor Cordova has taken a load tonight, so I'm trying to share the love around. Councillor Bain and a seconder in Councillor Street. All right, Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. So very similar to the last one, the purpose of this report is to seek council approval to commence the public advertising process associated with leasing the land, which is specifically the existing Twin Oval ground to the Tasmania Football Club. The only difference with this arrangement is that should the Devils choose to walk away from this one, the ground will return to council, not the state government, for our use. So I'm happy to support the recommendation.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. Just one seek of clarity for the community. Obviously, we're talking here about one oval only, but there are a bunch of tenant users that will be affected. I was just wondering if we could maybe put on the public record an opportunity to lay out the plans in terms of there will be four ovals. Are we able to say yet which configuration and who will be impacted and how we might manage that transition for those affected clubs in the next few years?
That has been a very complex process that has been worked through by the steering group along with some consultants, and Mr. Smee will be able to tell us all about it.
So principally the main affected tenant are the Tigers Football Club, because this is currently their home ground, and what we are proposing to lease to the Devils will become exclusively used by them and their associated teams. So the proposal is that there will be a new oval constructed on what is currently the site of the dog exercise area. That will then become the home ground for the Tigers. They will have their own set of club rooms, change rooms, facilities there, and that oval will be shared by the Tigers with the Devils and some of the other leagues, Coates League, Women's League. And in addition to that, to assist with the amount of teams we have to accommodate within the precinct, there is a proposal to that has been accepted as part of this project to develop a fourth oval, and that is between Gormley Park and Twin Ovals. So that fourth oval will have a turf wicket for use by the Kingborough Knights, and during the winter months it will be used by a number of different football teams for training purposes, as well as pre-season training for the Kingborough Tigers Football Club.
Councillor Dean.
Thank you to Mrs. Mead. Just to bring the record, I think we as councillors are fortunate to get briefings quite regularly on what's happening up there, but the focus is primarily around the centre usually, and just to put it out there as another opportunity, I appreciate Mrs. Mead explaining that for the general public. So that's all for me. Thanks, Mayor.
Thank you. Councillor Street.
I know this is only the notice of intention to dispose, and so I don't want to get too into the nitty-gritty, but just on a technical level, is it proposed that the lease is going to match up with the High Performance Centre lease as a 99-year lease?
Mr. Smee.
The lease for the High Performance Centre land may not be 99. The discussions indicate that it will probably be less than that. However, we're seeking council's approval to negotiate up to that term. But yes, the intent is the two leases would mirror each other in terms of the term and the essential terms and conditions.
Ms. Councillor Street. Mr. Street, I was about to...
Either or, you know, whatever. Does that mean that we're going to subdivide off the oval as well?
Mr. Smee.
That's correct. It will need, because of the requirement for a longer term lease than 10 years, it does require its own title. So we will have to go through a subdivision process for the oval in addition to the subdivision process for the High Performance Centre land.
Councillor Street.
Don't anticipate any issues with that, though.
No.
Good. Thanks. That's all.
Thank you. Any further discussions? No. As previously indicated, this is just going out to through the public consultation process for this, so people in the community will have an opportunity to have their say in this, as they do with any potential land disposal that council is undertaking. So I look forward to that process, and we will see it back. Councillor Midgley has a question.
Thank you. Just a question on that one. I note that we do like a regular community update newsletter sort of thing. Will that be promoted via that newsletter?
Mr. Smee.
We can do that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Bain. Did you want to sum up?
Thank you, Mayor. Just one final question. Given the different timeframes around this and the previous application, would the subdivisions be two separate subdivision applications?
Correct.
Yep, correct. Thank you. That's all.
That was not summing up. That was another question. But did you want to sum up now?
Consider it summed up.
Thank you. I'll put the recommendation, moved by Councillor Bain and seconded by Councillor Street. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. That takes us now to page 58, item 15.7, Community Services Strategy, with a recommendation on page 60. You've got a mover in Councillor Midgley and a seconder in the Deputy Mayor. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. So the notice of this report is in regards to the development of an overarching community services strategy. As we know, from time to time, we get different strategies come to us in the areas of youth positive ageing, arts and culture, LGBTIQA+, and multicultural. We have a a small but fierce team in our community services area who cover a lot. And from my reading of this report and discussions with the director of this area is that having it all under one overarching strategy means that the staff can track in regards to the actions and the plans. And also when we look at the, I guess, our community, you know, rather than having sort of separate strategies, it pulls it all together so you can have different themes and that affect, you know, youth and multicultural and LGBTIQA plus and inclusion and things like that. So it does make it a better working document, less kind of keeping track of things that have run out of time, coming to council, and all that sort of thing. My question around this is in a couple of questions. We did have some money in the budget for an Aboriginal action plan, or not sure if we're calling it a reconciliation plan. There's lots of different names from our communities in regards to where we go with that. But I guess will that form part of be included in this overarching strategy? And just generally, what are the kind of plans for that, considering there was some money in the budget for that?
Ms. Shikuti.
Oh, thank you. That's a really good question. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to look at that in more detail. We recognise that we need to do greater engagement with and have conversations with our Aboriginal community in Kingborough to understand what they would like to see council be doing in this space. So we don't actually know at this stage the form of what that work might look like, because it does need to be informed by those conversations. In saying that, we do believe there's some interim actions we can take to, I suppose, do some initiatives within council, increase awareness, training, working with our community team to do some more programming as well. So that's sort of the intent for this year's budget, and then moving forward it is, you know, that genuine intent to help have those conversations and properly engage. So yes, at this stage it will likely form a part of this proposed strategy. However, we're not at a point where we've, like I said, had those conversations to know what it needs to look like. So we kind of need to get to that point.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. And thanks for that information and understanding of the moving forward on that. A couple of other points, and in my other job I actually sit on a lot of different community services meetings for different councils around the southern region as well, so it's a bit of an interest of mine, I guess, a knowledge area. Sometimes councils also include the early years cohort and children and families, so I note that's sort of not named up in there, but we do know that there are a lot of, named young people, and young people are generally sort of 12 to 25, so there's a sort of 0 to 12 cohort that hasn't been named up. And also something to think about as well in the development and future aspiration of this strategy is around council and sort of the network meetings. A lot of councils seem to have different network meetings. So Glenorchy Council has a Thrive to 25 where they bring together like a number of stakeholders who are involved in the community services sector to come together and share. The Huon Valley Council has like a Huon Valley Services Provider meeting. So I guess I'm not sure if we do that, hold network meetings in our space, but I guess it's something to look after what other councils are doing in that area as well, if that could be considered. And my only other thought is just around the arts and culture being included within this broader strategy, because I feel like you've got like the people, the faces of the people and the different people that make up our community, whereas arts and culture, even though we provide arts and culture for the community, I haven't really found an arts and culture strategy embedded in like a community strategy, if that makes sense. They tend to sit alone on their own, and with that it is public art and all that sort of project
I think is very different to the community of people sort of orientated. So I guess for us to sort of reflect on whether that is a good fit. I can understand we do arts and culture programming with all the community members, but I think that is very different to kind of like our public art and art prize and acquisition and all that sort of thing. That was just some thoughts on there. And the other one was around just noting the communication and consultation. So the initial engagement is planned for 2026. An ongoing engagement will be integrated into the strategy framework. So I'm guessing from that we're going to sort of pull together all the different strategies that have been named up, and then that will form that one document, and then that will go out for some community conversation and engagement before it's finalised. Is that kind of what it looks like, or what does...
Ms. Shikushi.
What does that look like, please?
No, not exactly. So had this discussion with our community services team. We do actually want to do some targeted consultation for the different cohorts that this strategy will encompass. One, because those different cohorts engage differently and through different platforms and forums, and two, that we didn't feel that, I suppose, blanket consultation would properly ascertain the needs and values and gaps that we might have in our community. So we're using our recent data that we have, for example, for the Multicultural Action Plan, the Health and Wellbeing Strategy, but then we're going to do some targeted consultation for the ones that I suppose are out of date, and then develop the strategy. Haven't yet determined what, if there's going to be some additional consultation on the draft strategy at this stage. What would like to see is that as part of the strategy and the processes and the implementation framework that it sits under is that we are continuously gathering data and information and feedback from our community so that we can, shift priorities, etc., in our programming or in our services or networking, rather than sort of having to wait for a plan to finish and it then go out again, so that we'll be a lot more dynamic and responsive to our community.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. And it is a big part. I guess I just want to acknowledge this strategy might seem like, not much compared to all the other things that we do, but I'd like to acknowledge that our community services and some of our environmental programs are that front-facing work of what council does. And they're really positive. Often the positive feedback I receive about council is about a number of programs that sit under here. And the feedback even from the bake-off day to, their children getting the barista course, to other many other things that we run under these programs are really that front-facing element of council. And it is a really important way and vision forward, and a really, great thing that can support our team. So thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. And thank you to Councillor Midgley. Very well said. And there are some points within this that I'd like to highlight as well, that being that this planned engagement will commence in April with the development of the strategy to be completed by the end of 2026. What I liked, though, was to see that the work is ongoing in those various themes, irrespective of the fact that we're working on this comprehensive strategy. So drawing our attention to 4.9, it shows that this will be adaptive and responsive and flexible, and I think that's a really good thing as well. And I wanted to take the opportunity to talk about the great work that the team has already done, having achieved these big milestones with the LGBTIQA plus work and the positive ageing and arts and culture, and also the Multicultural Action Plan. And I recently attended a Peace and Social Cohesion event, and Kingborough is spoken on very highly with respect to the work that we've achieved and what our team does. I think that Councillor Midgley's point around separating out arts and culture is a critical one, because I think whilst it's always going to be more efficient and beneficial to have a comprehensive and integrated strategy, it's a point well made that the arts and culture community, the arts and culture well, the economic driver within arts and culture is just fundamentally different from that with when it comes to multicultural communities or inclusionary and access conversations. And I'll just point our attention to the various TV shows and films that have been done in Kingborough, because we make ourselves available to having TV shows from the mainland and internationally. That's a huge economic driver, and it's something that we should celebrate. So it's not just, I mean, although it is public art and having nice spaces and places for people to enjoy, it's also about embracing art and culture within Kingborough, because it can be a critical economic driver that brings more people to Kingborough and really gives us a economic prosperity, as well as a sense of identity and a thriving culture. So I'm interested to know how... I think the risk that I see is that by keeping arts and culture within this overarching comprehensive strategy, does that mean we'll be paying less attention to it, and potentially does that mean that a few opportunities might slip past us because we are not treating this as a separate area for us to expand into? Is there any commentary around that, particularly around attracting economic opportunities thanks to arts and culture?
Ms. Shakuti.
Thank you for the question, and really interesting and valid points that Councillor Midgley and yourself have raised. And we'll certainly take that feedback on board. As we've said in the report, we don't know the final structure of the plan, so we've got some flexibility. I suppose what I would say, I do recognise particularly, you know, the public art and, you know, instalments and attracting people to Kingborough, or, you know, having our community enjoy Kingborough because of its arts and culture is potentially a bit different to the other themes that we've named. Although, interestingly, one of my key observations is that arts, and particularly arts, but arts and culture is something we do in our community programming across the different themes, and the benefits from it are, you know, wide-ranging, from inclusivity, connectedness, diversity and understanding other people's cultures, and celebrating culture as well. At capacity building, public safety. So a really good example is we did some murals, and they actually had three benefits. So we used them through our youth program, where they did workshops with a local mural artist on the school holiday program. They were done on areas that either had graffiti or high risk for graffiti, so there was sort of a public safety and an amenity perspective to it, as well as having, you know, nice spaces and places for our community. So, yeah, I think we need to be careful not to completely separate it, because arts and culture actually deliver really amazing benefits for all the different cohorts in our community.
Just to sum up, if
Councillor
I may.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. It was a really wonderful response, and I deeply appreciated it, because those social pathologies, for example, we often hear about disengaged young people and how we address that, and I fully recognise the integration of arts and culture within addressing some of those social pathologies, whether it's social isolation among elderly folks, or whether it's disengaged young people, or this wonderful thing that happened recently with waste and recycling messages being painted onto the side of our waste disposal vehicles. Like, there's so many opportunities to integrate. But the reason why I specifically raised the television shows and the films coming in is because I wanted us to recognise, I guess, the economic integration as much as the harm reduction and the inclusivity mechanisms. But I think we can all agree that the enormous bang for buck that we get when, you know, the finance thing here at 5.1 says the current allocation is $5,500, and we think about this vast array of opportunities and programs and, you know, bringing people together in the municipality, that's a great spend, and I think we should do what we can to improve and increase those opportunities as we go forward. Thanks.
Thank you. Further contributions?
Look, just very briefly, I think this is a great step forward. Like Councillor Mitty, I'm amazed at the breadth of what we do within the community services portfolio and how much the small team is able to deliver to a really large cohort of people with different interests and across the community, and they've had a real focus lately on trying to do things in areas outside of Kingston to take into account some of the distances that people have to travel. So it's been great seeing that roll out. They're also incredibly good at getting grants. Like if you recall an update that we had, I think, at the AGM, I think it was last year or the year before, the amount of grants that, like just in the youth space, that they'd been able to secure in a short space of time was around, I think, about $1 million over 10 years or something. So quite phenomenal. So look forward to seeing this progress and, definitely support it. Councillor Midgley, did you want to sum up? All right, I'll put the recommendation by Councillor Midgley, seconded by the Deputy Mayor. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. Takes us to page 61, policy review. Item 4.13, establishment of bushfire hazard management areas on council land. Looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved, Councillor Antoli. Seconded, Councillor Midgley. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. We've been asked to have a review of the bushfire hazard management areas on council land policy. And this establishes or governs how council manages bushfire hazard management areas on land that is under our control. The policy provides, or aims to provide, I should say, a structured evidence-based framework for identifying and managing bushfire fuel risks, aligns council practices with TFS guidance, clarifies governance and delegation arrangements, and ensures mitigation actions are proportionate and defensible. The policy aims to balance public safety obligations, environmental protection and biodiversity values, community amenity considerations, an important one, and operation and financial capacity. And overall, it reinforces a proactive but risk-based approach to reducing bushfire exposure on council land. My first question is if council officers could help the community understand what is council land versus TFS responsibility, because that is something that comes up that confuses our community a lot.
Mr. Salter, you have been waiting all evening.
Poor man.
Welcome to the world of council meetings. If you don't have a gold dot, just put it somewhere in front of you.
That's good enough. That's all right. That's good enough.
Hopefully everyone can hear me okay. The land as defined in the policy is land that we actually directly own or we specifically manage. So TFS land would be state-owned or managed land.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. Could you give the community some examples about the land that we manage? I think that's probably the component, the interface between the land that we manage versus the land that the state manages.
Sure.
Maybe some Mr. Salter.
Sure. So bringing it back to the general numbers, if you will, there's only about 3% of the land within the municipality that we directly own or manage, so it is on numbers, it's about 3%. That would be things like Algona Reserve, Boronia Reserve, places like that. Beretta Waste Management Facility is still one where we're conducting business. And ones that we don't would be areas like the backside of the mountain. We've got areas up in Snug Tiers, for example, where we still give input into bushfire management plans and plant burning and things that are conducted through TAS Fire and Parks and Wildlife Service, but we don't directly manage that land.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. That's helpful. And with regards to Bruny Island, apart from the actual council land that we manage, the waste disposal centre or our community centre, are there any other areas that we manage on Bruny?
Mr. Salter.
I'd have to take that one on notice and just to be sure that I give you accurate information there.
Councillor Antoli.
Thanks, Mayor. No. Happy to support this, and it's obviously very important because of our bushfire history here.
Thank you. Any further conversations? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. I'm wondering if at all it's appropriate, or could it, I don't know, be thought about in this policy for the future around the cool burning, which we're hearing more and more about it, and biochar. And I don't know if it's appropriate to put forward in a policy like this, or whereabouts those sort of implementations and thoughts would be considered.
Mr. Salter.
Look, thank you for the question. It's actually, I suppose, the short answer is that it's, related through bushfire but unrelated in terms of this policy. So we do have intentions to do planned burning, and I'm having discussions at the moment about how we'll do that, and that is looking more towards cultural burning as or cool burning, as it may be, depending on who's conducting it. And that'll be based on really the reasoning for that is how we manage our reserves and balancing ecological impacts with actual fuel reduction as well. So that is one side of it, but it's not really based around this policy. And biochar, I guess, really falls into that same category, that it's a separate, semi-related issue, but not to do with this policy directly.
Any further questions? Councillor Antolli, did you want to sum up? Okay, I'll put the recommendation, moved by Councillor Antolli, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 76, Kingborough Waste Services, Director Remuneration, with a recommendation on page 77. Looking for a mover and a seconder. Moved, Councillor Richardson. Seconded, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. This one is pretty straightforward. The remuneration for the directors have been static since 2020. It's a modest increase of 3.6% on the 2020 remuneration. Given the time that has passed and the increasing requirements of directors and the importance of this this organisation, I think it is entirely reasonable to approve this modest increase in directors' fees.
Any further discussion? No. I'm going to put the recommendation, moved by Councillor Richardson, seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Page 78, financial report for January 2026, with a recommendation on page 80. Looking for a mover and a seconder. Moved, Councillor Bain, seconded Councillor Midgley. Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. So the financial report as at 31 January 2026, the overall state of play is that our original forecast budget deficit of $2.52 million has now been revised to $1.78 million. So a reduction of around $740,000 from our original budget deficit, which is great to see. So the forecast deficit is reduced by another $320,000 from the December report to January's. And I believe during that time in our finance area they had quite a deep dive looking at the forecasts. So I wonder if we can hear from the Director of Finance with a bit of a summary on what changes have been put in place with the forecasts.
Thank you. Mr. Spinks.
Thank you, Mayor. So it's correct that we had a bit of a closer look this month at the variances. So on the revenue side, we made a number of adjustments of around a fraction over $500,000, and on the expense side, adjustments of just under $200,000, so they netted off to the $323,000 that Councillor Bain has just mentioned. Some of the primary adjustments have been around the sports centre membership, so we know that's been tracking very favourably all year, so we've made a bigger adjustment there. Grant income, but on the flip side, the associated costs that come with that as well. The container refund scheme, so made an adjustment there of around $100,000. Interest earnings, of course, so cash balances, as we've noticed in previous meetings, are tracking a little bit better than we thought, so interest earnings have been favourable, so we've adjusted that up again. Employee costs we had quite a good look at, so we've got a number of vacant positions across the business, so I've done a measure up of that and made an adjustment accordingly. Materials and services, they've been adjusted for the offset on the grants income. and also for consultant costs. So we know that we've made some decisions to engage consultants across the business for a variety of reasons, so we've made adjustments for that. So the net result of that was a favourable adjustment of $320,000, which, as Councillor Boehner said, gets our forecast deficit down to $1.78 million.
Thank you. Councillor Bain.
Thank you. Just one more question. So Council recently engaged the planning consultants to review the landscape conservation zoning and a couple of the SAPs. And I remember at the time there were some concerns around the table and from ratepayers and what impact that would have on our bottom line. Can I just confirm that all those consultant costs have been included in the forecast that we see?
Yes, they have.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Further discussion? Councillor Dean.
Thanks, Mayor. Just one question for me around our CapEx program. I know there's been a bit of a push to try and not leave as much, many projects unspent. The figure that we've, I can see here is a 45% figure of unexpended capital works projects. So I'm just wondering if that's, we are making progress in terms of making sure that we're getting through the projects that we said we would, or is that still a work in progress?
Mr. Mackey.
Thank you for the question. I think year to date we expended about $6.9 million and we've got about $3.8 million of commitments. We're tracking towards expending of the total $20 million budget around $18 million at the moment, with the opportunity to potentially bring a project forward. So we're tracking pretty well to expend the capital project, capital budget, and we expect to have significantly less carryover projects into the next financial year.
Anybody else? Nope. Okay, I'm going to put the recommendation moved by Councillor Bain and seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. Looking for a mover and a seconder for the appendices on page 100. Moved Councillor Dean, seconded Councillor Midgley. Any questions? I doubt it because there's not really anything there. No. Okay, moving on. Oh, but I still have to have a vote on that. That the appendices be received and noted. Moved Councillor Dean, seconded Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Okay, takes us to still to page 100, item 16.1, notices of motion. Councillor Gladwright submitted a notice of motion headed Landscape Conservation Zone, and there is a response from Ms. Shikuti. So it's moved by the Deputy Mayor and a seconder in Councillor Antoli. Deputy Mayor.
Thank you. So this motion came about after a few of the councillors and the CEO and the Director of Environment, Development and Community Services attended a meeting that was hosted by CLUB, the Kingborough Land Users Body. While we were there, we heard about some issues that the community have been having when they've been applying for finance or applying for insurance, and it was related to development applications that are considered discretionary. We heard that the word discretionary has been interpreted to mean discretionary, which is quite understandable, and that lenders and insurance providers have then therefore considered that the development is a little bit risky, and then that has different implications. So we had a explanation from Delise, and she explained that discretionary doesn't actually mean discretionary, that discretionary is a term that is given when a development has been assessed against the original pathway, and if it doesn't meet all the criteria, then the proposal jumps across to a secondary pathway, which we name as discretionary. However, if the proposal meets all of the requirements in that secondary pathway, council must approve the development. If not, they're taken to the tribunal. So it kind of it's very, very misleading, that word discretionary, because it kind of sounds like it's up to council to kind of decide, are we going to go this way, are we going to go that way? But it's very misleading, because in actual fact, if the proposal meets all of the requirements of that secondary pathway, council really must approve that development. So it is a very misleading word. Hearing that feedback from the community, I think we have a responsibility to pass that feedback on. We're obviously not legislators, but we can be a voice for our community. We can let the State Planning Office know about what is happening in our community. The recommendation is that we just note the concerns that people are having, and that we write to the Minister for Housing and Planning and the State Planning Office just to outline what this confusing word is leading to in our community. So it's a bit of an interesting one. I'm really interested to see what other councillors have to say about it. It is just to do with semantics, and I think if there is a problem that we can identify, it's good to let somebody know about it in hope that it can be changed, because if that word could be changed to something that isn't so misleading, then maybe the community wouldn't be experiencing so many problems. So I just wanted to point out too that the title of this motion is Landscape Conservation Zone. That in itself is a little bit misleading. That was a mistake. That really should be titled something like Planning Scheme Semantics or something like that, because this is across all zones. It's not just in landscape conservation. So I'm really interested to see what everybody has to say. It was just kind of a thought that came into my head one night after that meeting, and I couldn't sleep and woke up the next morning and just wrote all this down. So interested to see what everybody has to say.
Thank you. Contributions. Well, I'll start, because I was at the meeting when this came up, and I think this is a very practical response to the issues that were raised by property owners at the meeting. From the experiences that some of them have had, particularly those who, there was one person there who was a mortgage broker who passed on the difficulties that some property owners have had in securing finance when the banks realise that their land is potentially could result in a discretionary application down the track. So obviously this is not something that we can solve alone, because it's part of LUPA, but I thank the Deputy Mayor for bringing this forward and having a go at trying to convince the state government that this is something that they should look at, when clearly it is, as the commentary from our staff say, it kind of is semantics. And it's clear to the planners, but it needs to be more clear to other people who are making decisions based on whether somebody should get insurance or should have money loaned to them for property and so on. So another alternative, I guess, down the path, we clearly write if this motion is successful, but it may also be that I could suggest that perhaps you might want to consider another motion, or maybe amend this one that we also write. We'd have to do it as a separate one. I was going to say a motion to a general meeting of LGAT to then have the whole sector vote on it at a meeting to lobby the state government as well, because I think those gives it a bit more impetus as well. So just a suggestion moving forward. So thank you for bringing this forward. Further contributions. Councillor Antoli.
As seconder, I obviously do support it. I was at the same said meeting, and everything you've said, Mayor, is correct. The clinch for me was when a lady who told us she was a registered mortgage broker had been repeatedly refused. And we don't know the whole scenario on a person's lending history. I just have to take what they said at face value, that the applicants that she was managing had been repeatedly refused finance because of this nefarious word discretionary. She had apparently done her best to explain in her own, I suppose, non-planning language to the aggregator that she probably works under what this all means, and it went nowhere. And she also mentioned that this was a really big issue on Bruny Island as well. So anything that helps to make our planning system more digestible, easy to use, so that people can actually get finance to build, to me, any clarification that needed is something I'm more than happy to support.
Thank you, Councillor Antolli. Anyone else? Councillor Dean.
Look, just broadly from my perspective, I don't have any issue at all with writing to the Minister and having them consider this. We're not really being too restrictive, although there are some suggestions in the motion about what other wording could be used. I'm just curious, it does feel a little bit more like, you know, words have multiple meanings in the English language and we can only do so much in terms of conveying that they have a certain meaning in the planning world, and if mortgage brokers and financiers have that. I was curious as to see whether, as a council, we've fielded questions from potential buyers or borrowers, whether they're coming to us and seeking some kind of proof around, obviously the mortgage broker themselves have tried to explain it, but whether we're fielding questions and are able to support anyone that does come forward and say, hey, we're struggling with our receiving finance. Is there anyone, could we receive a supporting letter from council to confirm that this is the process and have we been able to support anyone, is my question.
Ms. Shakuti.
Thank you. To my knowledge, we've not been approached by brokers or lenders seeking clarification or applicants. That doesn't mean that maybe it hasn't occurred, but just to my knowledge. We, of course, can't preempt the outcome of an assessment, but what we can do is provide, I suppose, as best as possible, what the actual meaning of discretionary is under the planning scheme and the Act. Another I noted in the notice of motion is that perhaps is an interim step that the state can take that doesn't involve changing legislation or planning schemes, which is a lengthy exercise to actually publish clearer information as to what the term discretionary means. But I am also sure there's other terms within the planning scheme that would benefit from clearer guidance as well. And particularly, I think, from the state, where, you know, perhaps it holds a little bit more gravitas than each council.
Councillor Dean.
That kind of answered my follow-up, that it sounds like we're going to be pretty... would be open to supporting someone if they're on strife with to navigate that in the absence of the state stepping in. So I've got no issues with the motion, but happy to hear what other people have to say.
Councillor Midgley? That was yes?
Councillor Midgley.
No, I wasn't sure whether you were putting your hand. You just got a like, little hand.
Sorry, waving.
Waving.
What do we do like this? Yeah, I guess for me, I'll be curious to see the outcome. The word's been used, yeah, for a long time, but I'd also acknowledge that it has been of a concern for the community, you know, highlighted over the last sort of year. And I think, yeah, it's a nonsensical, like it makes sense to do this. And basically we're advocating, and that's what we do as councillors, don't we? We listen to the community and we advocate, and that point around requesting clearer, publicly accessible information, explaining, you know, that, we absolutely do need that when we're working at the front of community, but understanding as well that we have to have this more legal and technical language at times as well. So, but yeah, I'll be curious to see where it goes, and thank you, Councillor Glade-Wright, for making the time to put this forward.
Any further contributions? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. To start with a brief question about have we... So we've heard that we haven't got any letters from brokers or banks or insurers about this issue, but have we... Well, we've heard that we haven't reached out to bankers, brokers or insurance, and also we haven't had letters evidencing this issue. Is that correct?
Ms. Shakuti.
To my knowledge, I'm not aware of any, but there may be.
And the second question is, wouldn't it be easier to kind of wouldn't it be easier to wait for any of the affected parties to reach out to us rather than asking the minister, for example? So I'm trying to figure out exactly what's the evidence of the harm. I'm just trying to find out what's the evidence of the harm.
Well, I think the evidence of the harm is that we've had multiple community members now who have indicated that they've been told that they can't secure loans because of the because of the word discretion, and that we haven't obviously asked to see. We're taking that on face value. We haven't asked to see evidence of loans being refused, but it's a repeated theme that we're hearing from a large number of people who have been discussing all the LPS issues.
In our experience of writing letters to the minister, which I'm sure we've done a bunch of times over the many years of this council, in our experience, does the minister ever? How often does the minister react to our letters by changing legislation? Would be one question. Has that ever happened in our history? Because, and I'm kind of hinting at, maybe it's easier to talk to the bankers, brokers, and insurers than it is to convince the minister to take this to cabinet and then pass it in a finely balanced parliament.
Well, I don't know how we'd be going talking to bankers and insurers and brokers ourselves. I don't think we've got the capacity to do that.
The evidence that they have a problem with it.
I think what we're trying to do is prevent the problem becoming at that pointy end where people are then keen to get their housing finance approved or not. I think what Councillor Bladerod is doing is trying to seek some clarity around the words so that it doesn't come to that situation where there's a refusal and then somebody has to try and get clarification or something. I mean, we... as Ms. Shakuti has said, we're limited in what we can provide in terms of, if a bank approaches us, we're limited in what we can say in response to that. It still has to go through the planning processes. So would that be enough for them? I don't know.
Thank you. So I think, firstly, to thank the Deputy Mayor sincerely for bringing the motion. It's important that we respond to community where concerns are raised. I think local education has already been raised as something that might help, like helping explain to people what these words mean. And Legat, I think, is probably the key vehicle, because this doesn't just affect Kingborough. If it is an issue, and I'm kind of questioning how much of an issue it is, but I want to take it face value and in good faith that, people have come to this council saying this is an issue, so let's take that in good faith. But we haven't yet seen any bank policies that say the word discretionary was the problem. We haven't seen any insurance brokers say the reason your premiums are going up is not because of bushfire risk or climate change or corporate profiteering. It's because of the word discretionary. I'm a little bit... No, I'm fully sceptical that there's a lot of reasons why banks...
A little bit or fully. Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons, I think, why banks refuse lending or why insurance companies raise premiums, and I don't think it's purely on the word discretionary, personally. Also, I just don't know how genuinely we believe that writing to the minister will see any tangible change. It's a finely balanced parliament. This is, among a Macquarie Point Stadium cost of living and housing. I just don't believe that the planning minister is going to receive this letter from us, run into the party room and say, this is the priority that we have to fight for. And remember that Lupa, Will Hodgman said in 2013 that Lupa was going to change, and we're still changing it, implementing it here 13 years later. So if we meaningfully want to have credibility with our community, we shouldn't promise them things that kind of... I mean, do we really believe that this is the salve that will help banks lend more or insurers bring down prices? I don't think it's true, but I think we owe it to the community to listen to their concerns, but I'm not sure that passing this particular, writing a letter to the minister that may end up on the floor of the waste paper bin rather than the floor of parliament is the actual way to do it. I don't think we're fully acknowledging the magnitude of change that is required to get something in Lupa altered. I don't think we're acknowledging that you would have to consult with stakeholders all across the state of Tasmania. I don't think we're acknowledging that in 36 years of Lupa using the term discretionary, which, bear in mind, is the core centrepiece of the planning framework, this concept of discretionary, I don't think that this has kind of come up before. So I just don't know why it's our crusade to have a state level letter-writing campaign to the minister when I just don't think that genuinely the minister will take it seriously. discretionary has a specific legal meaning, and it's been in use since 1993. And I think we can do a lot of work within the local community to help people understand what that means. But without any evidence, how are we actually supposed to make our claim to Minister Vincent that this is should be a priority for them to consider? Like, we will have to provide some evidence that these are the policies that are causing people to not get financing or have insurance premium hikes. And we just don't have that in front of us, and I don't know how we're going to collect that in time to give to the Minister with some sense of credibility. And I do think also that resources at Council sometimes are plentiful, but they're not unlimited, and we could write a lot of letters, but if they kind of don't do anything, I just don't know if it's the right way forward. I don't know that it gives us enough. I don't know if it's really going to help anything, but having said that, it's probably limited harm, and if it makes people feel better, well, it's a little bit performative, I guess, to that extent. There are reforms in Looper that are worth changing. We mentioned them tonight, health and wellbeing, social inequality. These are changes that are meaningful. Changing one word to a synonym meaning the same thing but with slightly different semantic language is not a powerful, meaningful or realistic change that we can undertake. And if it takes 13 years to get there, what's even the point of sending a letter in the first place? We can act locally. We can do something with clearer guidance, better information, stronger pre-lodgement support, plain English explanations for what discretionary actually means. But my position on this one is that if we do want to bring this forward to the state government and ask them to make some changes in a finely balanced parliament, then we need to provide more written evidence that there's a cause and effect. The cause was the word discretionary and the effect was higher insurance premiums or bank lending. Otherwise, it's just... I just don't think that it's going to help or change anything much. So I think I'm leaning towards voting against. But thank you again to the Deputy Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Fox.
Well, I know that since 1988, councillors from the beginning when I started were grappling with this word discretionary. But every time it came up, every councillor that got elected had to have it explained to them by the planning staff. And once they understood it, I think it's become clear. It just means that it could go either way depending on certain criteria. And if we're going to replace a word with the discretionary with something else, why haven't we come up with an alternative? And I think that's going to be hard for anybody. I think at the end of the day, they'll probably come back again to the same word, discretionary. So has anyone around the table thought of an alternative word?
The Deputy Mayor.
I purposely didn't put in a suggestion because, like I said before, we're not legislators. It's really up to more qualified people than us to come up with an alternative. Just to the evidence thing, it's really easy to get some letters from the people who attended that meeting, so that would be very, very easy if that is something that concerns you. But I think the evidence actually comes from Ms. Chakoudi, who explains it really, really well, that discretionary doesn't mean discretionary at all. Discretionary is just a description of a secondary pathway, and it really needs to have something else there that's got nothing to do with a discretion, because it just simply does not mean discretion. So, sorry, I'm taking over.
Sorry, Councillor Fox, have you finished or have you got further questions?
Well, I guess over the years nobody's come up with a better alternative, and I think when it comes to, none of us around the table are planners. We're not trained in this field. And I think we're treading on dangerous waters to be responding to a community group that hasn't provided evidence. And even if they could have, they haven't. But apart from that, I feel the greater community seems to understand it. The developers, over the years have accepted it and understand it. The residents and the councillors have understood it. I don't see the urgency for making change, particularly not as an individual council. If other councils are having exactly the same problem, then let them raise the issue too. But at this point in time, I don't think we should put our head above water and say, let's do something. Like Councillor Cordover, I feel the same way. I just don't think it's something that's that urgent and that important. So I don't support the motion.
Councillor Cordover. And then Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. The question is, wouldn't it benefit our letter to the Minister if the language was strengthened significantly in number two, where it currently says, regarding how the term discretionary may be interpreted by some external organisations and the potential implications relating to finance, lending, insurance, wouldn't it actually mean more if it said the term discretionary is interpreted by these external organisations, which has implications on this? Like, rather than using this very vague language, which I think undermines the intention, which is ultimately to change an Act of Parliament, to change LUPA, that's the intention, which is a big ask, but if that's what we genuinely want, then it should have some strong language. Wouldn't it be benefit from having stronger language?
The Deputy Mayor.
Sure. I'd love to put stronger language in there. I actually sought some advice from Ms. Chikuti and she helped me draft that. But, yeah, I'm all for strong language. I think it's if that's going to help, then yeah, why not? I know it's a big ask, but change starts somewhere, right? And the more voices that raise issues, then the more chance that change will come about. So yeah, it might be a big ask, but why not?
So Councillor Cordover, you suggested some particular words for the Deputy Mayor, and if so, did you want to consider those for a possible amendment that you can't move yourself but somebody else might move on your behalf?
Yeah, I'd be happy to take on that stronger language. I guess the way it's worded, it's a little bit more open, so maybe there's benefit in that. And I'd like to hear, maybe Ms. Shakuti's got...
Ms. Shakuti.
Can I make a suggestion?
Please do.
Rather than trying to come up with a stronger language here, could we amend the motion that, you know, a letter be developed and circulated to councillors with our sort of request and recommendation to the state, so that we can actually kind of have a little bit more of a think about what that language might be, and perhaps, you know, review some other planning legislation in Australia that might have some ideas, etc.
Hang on 2 seconds. Although, no, sorry, if it's a procedural motion, I have to take it straight away. Yep, what's the procedural motion?
Oh, my procedural motion was going to be to move to defer it so that we could strengthen language and come back when we know what the organisations are that we're targeting, or I shouldn't say targeting, but, you know, who are the external organisations, what are the implications, and so the three ones, maybe we could change maybe to discretionary is interpreted by insert organisations here, and the implications are dot, dot, dot. So it actually means something rather than just says maybe, potentially, some nondescript organisations that we're deliberately not mentioning. So can't we just defer this until it's got more specificity? Because right now I think it's too vague. That's why I was going to move to defer it. But maybe can we just... I'm going to vote against, I think, actually. Because so, unless people have some ideas on what...
Are you making a motion, okay, or are you using it as an opportunity for a second contribution?
No, Councillor Street, over to you.
Thank you, Mayor. Look, I'm going to make this really brief because the amount that I can usefully contribute at 25 past nine is pretty limited. This is a tale as old as time. For my sins, which apparently are really significant, I've done quite a bit of property conveyancing over the years, and finance applications being knocked back because a lender says that a property is in an area where residential development, or in a zoning where residential development is discretionary, is a tale as old as time. It has been happening for a long time. It doesn't matter how much you argue with a financier that it doesn't mean what they think it means. I have been through that process a few times on behalf of clients, and I've never been able to get through that that's what it means. So this is not a particularly new issue. I don't ascribe to the view that because something's difficult, we shouldn't pick up the pen. And look, while I might not necessarily agree with the entirety of the rationale, I accept that the problem has been a problem for a long time, and I've got no issue with writing to the minister to indicate that, so that when legislative reform is considered, perhaps it is considered as part of it.
And then we can take credit for it. No, just joking. It's late and we're all tired. Okay, so any further contributions? Councillor Bain.
Thank you, Mayor. Just to say I support the recommendation, and I guess I think everyone's of the same view that requesting consideration of the change of the name, the use of the term discretion, might be a bit of a long shot. I figure that even if we can get requests clear, publicly accessible information explaining the discretionary assessment process, that's going to be a win. So it's well worth picking up the pen, like Councillor Street said. It's not hard.
Thank you. Further contributions? Councillor Gladwright, did you want to sum up?
No, just to say that we can't expect lenders and insurance providers to be experts in planning. And so when they come across a word discretionary, they think it means discretionary, but it doesn't. So it's quite obvious that there's an issue there. So thanks for all your contributions.
Thank you. Put the recommendation, moved by Councillor Gladwright, seconded by Councillor Antoli. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
No.
A show of hands is required. All those in favour? Ms. Councillors Antoli, Dean, Bain, Midgley, Richardson, Street, Gladwright and Reet, and those against, Councillors Fox and Cordova, the motion is carried. Takes us to page 103, confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. In accordance with Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations 2025, Council by absolute majority moves into closed session to consider the following items: confirmation of minutes, applications for leave of absence, and CEO's performance review. Looking for a mover and a seconder. Got a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in the Deputy Mayor. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. Thank you very much to our staff who have stayed the distance. Greatly appreciated. Thank you to those who joined us this evening in the public gallery who have all since gone home, but we welcome them having been here earlier. And thank you to those who have lasted on the screening of this on YouTube to the very end at 9:30 p.m. If it was a choice between watching maths and this, what would you do? Open session of council now adjourns at 9:29 p.m. Good evening.